You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And it's all the rhetoric of pro-democracy. I call it the weaponization of democracy and human rights. And this has become, in the last 30 years since NED was created, something called the National Endowment for Democracy. It's become a huge industry and a very refined, very polished, and very effective regime change apparatus.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy, How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. William Engdahl is an international political analyst and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. He is also author of The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we discuss his new book, Manifest Destiny, Democracy as Cognitive Dissonance. William Engdahl, welcome back to Guns and Butter.
Bonnie, I'm delighted to be back with you.
You write in your introduction to your new book, Manifest Destiny, Democracy as Cognitive Dissonance, that at the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the old USSR, that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Colin Powell told Army Times in April 1991, quote, "Think hard about it. I'm running out of demons. I'm running out of villains. I'm down to Castro and Kim Il-sung," end quote. You write that the dilemma was soon to be resolved. Washington unveiled a dramatic new weapon, fake democracy, non-governmental organizations, NGOs, that would be used to covertly create pro-Washington regimes in strategic parts of the world. According to your book, it all started early in 1983 when Reagan's CIA director, William Casey, convinced Reagan to create a kind of shadow CIA, a private non-governmental organization that would escape the scrutiny and criticism of the CIA. That NGO was the National Endowment for Democracy. What was the stated purpose of the National Endowment for Democracy, and what was its real purpose?
First of all, the name National Endowment for Democracy was chosen deliberately for its resonance with other government agencies, such as the National Endowment for Humanities or National Endowment for Arts. So this word endowment makes it sound very noble, philanthropic. But the aim of it, Alan Weinstein, who wrote the legislation to create NED back in the 80s under Reagan, gave an interview to the Washington Post years later. He said, a lot of what we do today was done covertly years ago by the CIA. And that really says it all right there. You have to go into the context of the early 1980s. You had congressional committees, you had the Church Committee, you had Gerald Ford, this was a little bit earlier, in the 70s, you had Gerald Ford appointing a committee with Nelson Rockefeller in charge to examine all these accusations that the CIA was running rogue operations, was running assassination and regime change around the world from Iran to Guatemala and Chile with Pinochet dictatorship and so forth. And Casey was looking, as Reagan's CIA chief in the early 80s, Casey was looking for a way to take the spotlight, the heat off of the agency. And he and several people around him came up with the idea of creating, of privatizing the CIA destabilization dirty tricks functions. And that became the National Endowment for Democracy.
Well, what did they say that the purpose of the National Endowment for Democracy was?
The stated purpose in the legislation would be to promote democracy, promote human rights against totalitarian governments around the world that are anti-democratic. And they would do it with taxpayer dollars. So this is the part about it that isn't so widely discussed, but the big money for the NED, let's call it, comes from the U.S. Congress. It's a government-funded operation, and it works in collaboration with something called the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, connected with the State Department, but de facto connected with the CIA. It's used all around the world as a conduit for CIA dirty tricks and arms smuggling and so forth. So the National Endowment for Democracy was, I call it a brilliant tactic of the U.S. government to create dirty tricks against people that it's not fond of. And one of the neocons, Joshua Muravchik of Freedom House, the CIA front, said the idea of the NED was to create, quote, a second layer of insulation between recipients of U.S. government money and the U.S. government, and that funds originating in the Treasury distributed by an independent private agency would not be tied to any particular U.S. administration, and these are more acceptable. So if China finds that something called the National Endowment for Democracy is trying to create a, you know, revolution in China against the Communist Party, it doesn't sound as sinister as saying that the CIA has been caught with their hands in the cookie jar. So that's more or less the way it has been constructed. And it's all the rhetoric of pro-democracy. I call it the weaponization of democracy and human rights. And this has become, in the last 30 years since NED was created, it's become a huge industry and a very refined, very polished, and very effective regime change apparatus.
What is the National Democratic Institute, the NDI, and what are the other National Endowment for Democracy affiliates? Because the NED is not the only one, right?
Right. There are essentially four of these. And the National Democratic Institute is loosely affiliated with the Democratic Party. Keep in mind, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the two main parties in the United States today, are not entirely clean organizations, as is not the AFL-CIO. And all three of those are connected through these subsidiaries of NED. For example, when you have a democratic or social democratic government in some part of the world, let's say in South America or whatever, and they have fraternal relations with the U.S. Democratic Party, then the National Democratic Institute would be the vehicle that would be used to influence that government. And the head of the National Democratic Institute today is Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State during the Yugoslav War. So, and then the other daughter institutes are the International Republican Institute, which has a more right-wing profile. It's tied to the Republican Party, but independent. And it's funded also by USAID, which is, as I said earlier, a conduit often for the CIA's dirty tricks. And it's headed by Senator John McCain, at least up until his recent illness, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. So John McCain was instrumental in the coup d'etat in Ukraine, for example, in 2014, as head of the IRI, International Republican Institute, of the National Endowment. And the other one is called the Solidarity Center, which is tied to the AFL-CIO Labor Federation, going back to Walter Reuther and the Cold War days in the 1950s, the AFL-CIO has always had a fairly tight relation, internationally at least, with the U.S. State Department and the intelligence community. And then finally, there's something called the Center for International Private Enterprise, which is tied to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So those four are the four arms of the National Endowment for Democracy, and they disperse grant money in all sorts of very sly and subtle ways to create regime change around the world.
Wow, that's very interesting. And all these four offshoots of the National Endowment for Democracy, they're all funded through the government, correct?
That's correct, yes.
At the very same time as the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy, the Soros Foundation was founded in 1984 in Budapest, Hungary, by currency speculator George Soros, who had been born there. Do you think that these two NGOs, the National Endowment for Democracy and the Soros Foundation, which were founded at the same time, were working together from the very start?
I would be shocked if somebody could prove to me that they were not working together from the very start. Every place where the U.S. State Department wants to make regime change, whether it be Ukraine, whether it be Poland back in the end of the 80s, early 90s with its shock therapy and so forth, whether it be Myanmar or whatever, the Soros Foundation is inevitably there right by side of the National Endowment for Democracy and Freedom House and a few others. So it's a battery, if you will, a battery of NGOs, fake democracy NGOs, I call them, that are deployed so that it appears from every single different direction there's this huge popular movement for change in different countries. And the change is always geared toward the benefit of the U.S. State Department's agenda at any particular time.
Now, according to your book, George Soros recruited Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard University to work with him in the Soros Foundation. Was Jeffrey Sachs recruited by Soros early on in the founding of the Soros Foundation?
Well, it's at the very latest by the end of the 1980s when the Reagan administration was, and then the later George Bush Sr., were involved in toppling the communist government in Poland using Solidarność, the Lech Wałęsa's trade union umbrella organization. And so the Soros and Jeffrey Sachs were working very, very closely, first in Poland, where shock therapy was applied in the first case through Jeffrey Sachs called it shock therapy. And the idea of that was you have state enterprises that have existed for some 45 years in Poland and Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia then and Hungary and other countries. So the only way to get rid of the habits of communism, argued Jeffrey Sachs, was to have an economic shock to free the prices up immediately, to let them go to world market prices. But the wages in those countries were not freed up. So you had a huge unemployment. You had bankrupting of state-owned enterprises. And then people like George Soros would move in for the kill and using dollars, because the currencies were collapsing in these countries, using American dollars, they were able to buy up the crown jewels of Poland and other countries for pennies. So that's the shock therapy model. And Soros and Sachs worked very closely, not only in Poland, but later in the former Soviet Union.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy: How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that the first target of the CIA's new democracy NGO, the National Endowment for Democracy, was to infiltrate and subvert the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union itself. Since Poland was considered the weak link in the Warsaw Pact, the attack began there. Why was Poland considered the weak link in Moscow's chain of control?
The key to the Poland transformation or destabilization of the Communist Party was the election of Pope John Paul II and the diplomacy of Ronald Reagan and the Reagan administration with Pope John Paul II. He had a meeting in 1982 when Ronald Reagan first became president. Reagan went to the Vatican and privately met the Pope, the new Polish Pope. And they agreed to a clandestine campaign to simply bring down the communist Warsaw Pact alliance. And it was described by Richard Allen, the national security advisor at the time to Reagan, as one of the great secret alliances of all time. Because Moscow was never able politically to significantly weaken the influence of the Catholic Church in Poland. They had to tolerate it. And there's a quite, if it's accurate or not, we'll never know, but quite a telling comment from Edward Gierek, the head of the Polish Communist government then, in a cabinet session where it was announced that Wojtyla, the Polish foreign cardinal, had just been elected Pope in 1978, and Gierek reportedly said, "Oh God, what are we going to do now? Jesus and Mary, this is the end." This is from a communist leader. So I can imagine that something like that was the case, because then the National Endowment for Democracy, in coordination with a network of priests in Poland that the Vatican recruited to this, were able to smuggle in fax machines and, you know, all sorts of equipment to Solidarność in order to begin getting out propaganda against the communist government. The Free Trade Union Institute of the NED played a crucial role in that. And they put tens of millions of U.S. dollars into that destabilization.
So would you say then that for the Vatican to name a Polish pope, that that was a strategic move politically from the very start? I mean, that's why John Paul II was chosen, wouldn't you think?
Well, this gets into a controversy over the College of Cardinals. There are different accounts from Catholic scholars who say that Washington exerted strong influence on the College of Cardinals to get John Paul II elected. I'm not in a position to prove that one way or the other. But what is clear is that once a Polish pope was in the Vatican as pope, the Reagan administration began to work with him to bring down the communist regime and open the door for the church to come back in.
Right. And I think it's very significant that the role of George H.W. Bush in all of this, he began as Reagan's vice president, of course, and then went on to become president from 89 to 93. And that's when all of these destabilizations really got rolling.
Yeah.
With regard to the Polish Pope, John Paul II, then Ronald Reagan, with George H.W. Bush, et cetera. They're all working with the CIA, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, George H.W. Bush had been the director of the CIA back in the 70s, and he always maintained a close network of CIA old boys that he worked with inside the agency as well as outside, supposedly private.
Yes, I was surprised to read in your new book, Manifest Destiny, that actually it was President Carter who had, what, fired 300 CIA agents that had worked under George H.W. Bush as CIA director. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And then Bush kind of regrouped these ex-CIA pals of his, or whatever you want to call them, into private entities that continued as kind of a rogue CIA.
What role did Solidarnosc, the Polish trade union, play in the looting and asset stripping of Poland? And was this Polish trade union different from other trade unions in Poland?
The Solidarnosc, you remember the Polish dock workers, ship workers in the north of Poland, where Lech Walesa, the trade union leader of Solidarnosc, was based. And he eventually got a Nobel Peace Prize, like Barack Obama, for loyal service to the U.S. government, I guess. But he and Solidarnosc led mass demonstrations in Poland, which conveniently hid the role of the church. And those demonstrations effectively were so big that they brought down the Communist Party. And in 1990, the Communist Jaruzelski resigned as Polish leader, and Walesa, the head of Solidarnosc, was elected president. And that, in answer to your question, that is the point at which Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard University and the shock therapy and George Soros were given essentially a free rein to strip the Polish economy of anything of value. And they did a pretty good job. They went together with an IMF program, International Monetary Fund, in 1990. And Soros had a foundation called the Stefan Batory Foundation in Warsaw. And they simply destroyed the old Polish economy. The government was not allowed to create national bank money to finance budget deficits. So you had no choice but, according to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, to have savage austerity, cut the government expenses. That led to hundreds of thousands of Polish government employees out of work. And then price controls, government price controls were ended. Apartment rents, costs for fuel, for transportation, heating were suddenly at Western market levels instead of these subsidized Eastern Soviet levels. And then French, Italian, German products were allowed to be imported free of tariff. And this Soros Sachs shock therapy was called the Balcerowicz plan, to give it a Polish kind of fig leaf. The finance minister was Leszek Balcerowicz at the time. The result of the shock therapy is inflation rose almost 600% in the first year. And the currency, the zloty, was in a free float against the dollar and dropped like a stone. So this is what was done to Poland. And then once you pushed the economy and the wage levels down to the bottom, you could open up the economy for sale to Western buyers like German industry or French or whatever. And that's essentially the history of Poland at the time.
Now, how did they kick off the economic shock therapy in Poland? Was Poland in debt to the IMF? Was that how this started?
Well, it was in debt during the 80s. Poland began borrowing, or in the 70s, actually. Poland, like Yugoslavia, began borrowing from very willing to lend Western banks like Chase Manhattan or Citigroup or J.P. Morgan and so forth. And at that time, they were separate. The dollar debts of Poland were, at the time of the early 80s and the destabilization, they were simply out of proportion. They were unpayable. So that was the basis on which the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was brought in, say, okay, you want Western credits. This was the trade-off that was promised under Harvard shock therapy. You want Western bank credits to finance your economy and invest in your economy. You have to follow the dictates of the International Monetary Fund from Washington. And those dictates were to simply like an asset stripping of the Polish economy.
What surprises me about all of this with regard to Poland and other countries is mm-hmm. that under communist rule, why would they be borrowing money from Western banks?
They were borrowing because they had to have hard currencies to invest in the economy. And the stresses of the Soviet Union in the 80s to keep up with the military buildup of the Reagan administration, the debacle in Afghanistan, Nicaragua, and various other things where the West was putting simultaneous pressure on Moscow. Moscow was increasing the pressure on the Comecon, the Eastern European economies, to finance its military budget to keep up with the U.S. So to keep its population content as much as possible, they began borrowing from the West, from Western banks. And at the beginning of the borrowing, the interest rates were very low. And then into the 1980s, there came this Paul Volcker shock therapy in the early 80s, and the interest rates went soaring. And that's when they had to borrow more money to roll over the old debt and whatnot. They got into a debt trap. And that was, I think, very deliberately done by the West.
Oh, I see. So it was the United States' pressure on the Soviet Union with the arms race, etc., that began to bankrupt the USSR, and then that had a domino effect in the Warsaw Pact that Moscow couldn't be as big of a help to these countries, perhaps, as it had been in the past. Yeah,
more or less that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That energy subsidies, they got their energy from Russian, gas fields, Siberian gas fields, and so forth. So the Russian government, or the Soviet government then, had to increase the cost of natural gas to the Polish economy, things like that. So then that has a knock-on effect throughout the whole economy.
Now, you also mentioned that the Polish government was not able to issue its own credit, meaning that somehow the U.S. and the Soros Foundation, et cetera, was able to dollarize the Polish economy. Is that right?
Exactly what they did, and they did the same thing later with Russia, Russian Federation, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But that was dictated by the International Monetary Fund. So they had a debt crisis. The Western creditors were demanding their pound of flesh. The government of Lech Walesa said, well, what do we do? And they said, you have to free float the zloty, the Polish currency, against the dollar and create market conditions. And your central bank can't print money to paper over the crisis. So it's created catastrophe. And, it was a completely predictable catastrophe for the real economy.
Yeah, well, dollarizing the economies of countries through the IMF, I mean, this is what's done constantly, right? It just happened in Brazil a couple of years ago. Same thing,
sure.
Right?
Sure, it's always the same recipe by the IMF. They force these governments to free float their currency, devalue it, drastically against the dollar. And then the only currency of real value seemed to be the dollar, so it has that effect.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy, How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that the 1986 oil price collapse that was engineered by the U.S. State Department and Saudi Arabia hurt Russia tremendously. Was that its intent? Was this 1986 oil price collapse, was that all orchestrated in order to hurt Russia?
I think it was, and I've written about this in several of my books, Myths, Lies, and Oil Wars, among them Century of War. And I've looked at the State Department documents when George Shultz was Secretary of State and George Bush Sr. was vice president, but very active, hands-on, de facto foreign policy president under Reagan. And they worked with the Saudis. The Saudis wanted to regain domination of the oil pricing within OPEC, and the U.S. wanted to do a number of things. One, Bush wanted to become president in 1988, and a dramatic collapse of the oil price would give the economy a nice shot in the arm so that people would have a feel-good effect, and good economy means Republicans are easy to reelect, or George Bush Sr. But I think the effect on bringing down the Soviet Union was the centerpiece of that 1986 oil price collapse. And what it did, it was done at the same time that the Reagan CIA and the National Endowment for Democracy were promoting the Solidarność in Poland. They were doing the Afghan Mujahideen operations against the Soviet Red Army in Afghanistan and against the pro-Moscow government in Nicaragua. So on every corner, Moscow was under huge pressure. Plus, Reagan had announced in 1983 what the press called Star Wars, this ballistic missile defense program that really, and I know from Russian think tanks shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, told me that really was the straw that broke the camel's back to try to keep up military spending with the U.S. missile defense initiative. So all of this put huge strains on Russia, and Bush played the key role in that.
What were Executive Orders 12333 and then Executive Order 13233, which was Bush Jr., George W. Bush?
Essentially, what those executive orders did was, it's a well-known secret in Washington that Ronald Reagan was not a hands-on president, especially in foreign policy, and he signed an order, an executive order, 12333, a national security directive, actually was drafted by Bush's people, Bush's vice president, that effectively, secretly put George Herbert Walker Bush in charge of all Reagan U.S. foreign and national security operations after 1981. And when George W. Bush became president in 2001, one of the first things he did was to sign another executive order, which claimed as national security the grounds to conceal records of past president, especially his father during the collapse of the Soviet Union. So those two taken together have kept most of the nefarious activities of the Bush family and the CIA and the U.S. State Department in the destruction of Russia in the 1990s from the public eye.
What was George H.W. Bush's network, the Enterprise? How was it formed and what did it do?
If you remember back in the later part of the Reagan administration in the 1980s, you had Colonel Oliver North and other intelligence officials around the Bush networks that were involved in something that became called the Iran-Contra affair. And the Iran-Contra were the Nicaraguan Contras. They were anti-communist. They were supported by the CIA and U.S. government. They were also involved in heavy drug running into airfield in Arkansas called Mena, Arkansas, when William Jefferson Clinton was governor. So we'll leave that aside for now. But the Iran-Contra operation was ultimately run by something that was known in their correspondence, in their kind of covert deep state that called itself the Enterprise. And they worked directly for Vice President Bush. And what they were engaged in was violating the laws of Congress, essentially, to sell weapons to Iran and also to the Contras in Nicaragua, where Congress didn't want to get involved. So that almost brought down George Bush, except for the fact that he was able to sweep it under the rug and get Reagan to pardon him from any prosecution. So the Enterprise, so this was General Richard Secord, Colonel Oliver North, and a whole network of handpicked CIA old boys. They were kept together, the machinery was kept together to begin to go into the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, well before the collapse, and began cultivating corrupt KGB generals. And this was the real origins of the Russian oligarchs, not so-called Russian organized crime, as the Western media called it, but it was a CIA, a George Bush operation to recruit KGB generals that were corruptible, that would do anything for becoming a billionaire in the collapse of their own Soviet state.
Well, that's very interesting. Then George H.W. Bush's the Enterprise Network were the ones that initially corrupted these KGB officers, which then ultimately, of course, led to a very complex, decades-long looting and stripping of Russia. Is that right?
I call it in my book, in the Manifest Destiny book, I call it the rape of Russia, and that's... There's no other term that describes what was done by this operation of George Bush Sr. and the CIA old boys around him and the bankers that he worked with. They put Boris Yeltsin in as their handpicked man to loot the Russian treasury of its gold reserves, for example. The Yeltsin family was a mafia, included the so-called oligarchs that emerged with the privatization of all these state assets, the world's largest aluminum company, some of the world's largest and most high-tech military companies. You had privatization of mostly raw materials, and just huge fortunes were being made by these oligarchs and their bankers in the West.
What was George H.W. Bush's Operation Hammer? Was it a four-part plan? And what was it?
Bush, you know, the CIA likes these acronyms. Operation Hammer was the destruction and attack on the post-communist Russian Federation, the destruction of the Soviet Union. So the West brought down the Soviet Union in a very, very determined way. If you want to understand the real roots of the animosity, the venom between Washington, between the State Department, the CIA, U.S. intelligence, British intelligence, and Russia under Putin, you have to really understand what I detail in the book in terms of the rape of Russia and the role of the U.S. in the early 90s under Yeltsin. So Operation Hammer called for the CIA to secretly finance the famous general's coup against Gorbachev back in August 91. That was the coup that brought Boris Yeltsin on top of the tank outside the White House in near Red Square in Moscow. And Western media very quickly pushed Yeltsin as the great democratic hero against the corrupt and dictatorial Gorbachev. And then the next part of the Operation Hammer, they'd use a secret financial resources, a war chest, to destabilize the currency, the ruble, you know, to collapse it. And then they corrupted officials of the National Bank, it was called Gosbank under the Soviet times, to steal the Russian Federation official gold reserves. And the final phase was the privatization of strategic energy, raw materials, high-tech military industry in the Soviet Union. And that was done with the IMF dictated privatization. It was done again with Harvard's Jeffrey Sachs and other Harvard economists working in Moscow, and Yeltsin's finance minister, Yegor Gaidar, and George Soros, of course.
You write about Riggs Bank of Washington, D.C., and Republic Bank of New York, about Riggs Volmet S.A. How were George H.W. and Jonathan Bush connected to these banks, and what was the purpose of these banks?
The money that these oligarchs were making, as long as it stayed in Russia, was very vulnerable. If Yeltsin would ever be toppled and God forbid, someone like Vladimir Putin, a nationalist, would become president, then those assets could be seized. So these oligarchs needed to get their money out of Russia, and there the Bush networks, the CIA old boys and so forth, came willingly to the service of these new Russian oligarchs, these new billionaires. So one of the key banks, it's now changed name and so forth, was a bank in Washington, D.C. called Riggs Bank. And since the 1960s, Riggs Bank had been known as a CIA bank during the Cuba Bay of Pigs operation. And the Riggs Bank had created an international banking group called Riggs Falmet, you mentioned. And the brother of George Herbert Walker Bush, now President Bush, Jonathan Bush, worked with Riggs Bank to set up Riggs Valmet in Geneva to launder the money of these Russian oligarchs. So you really have an incestuous operation where the Russian oligarchs are completely dependent on these Western banks that are connected with the CIA. So, any time the U.S. government would want to, they could pull the plug on these oligarchs if they stopped, doing what they were told to do.
I'm speaking with scholar and author William Engdahl. Today's show, Fake Democracy, How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And I think you write that Antigua became the destination for much of the looted Russian assets. And I suppose that worked the same way?
Yeah. Antigua, the Isle of Man, which is an offshore money laundering center that the British controlled. Shell companies were set up so you could never trace this. And it's interesting to note, Bonnie, that the names of these oligarchs, they were young meaning in their 30s and 40s, proteges of these old KGB generals that worked with the Bush enterprise, Operation Hammer. And among them were Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the one who later became famous as the head of Yukos Oil and later became put in prison for corruption and fraud and tax avoidance by the Putin presidency. But Roman Abramovich, who went on to buy a football club in the UK and left Russia, and Boris Berezovsky, who was one of the nastiest of these young oligarchs, and they were known as the kids of the corrupt KGB generals. They were trained by these Western bankers like Jonathan Bush and others to launder money. They were trained in money laundering. So the levels of corruption and financial incest involved in the rape of Russia by the West, by the CIA, by George Bush's networks, and then as soon as he became president, the Bill Clinton with Larry Summers as deputy treasury secretary running these Harvard economists out of Moscow.
What can you tell us about the Russian bank Menatep? I believe in your book you say that Khodorkovsky actually had acquired 100 state enterprises before he ever even got a hold of Yukos Oil.
Yeah. Well, he was on the inside. These young prospective oligarchs were working with the Yeltsin finance ministry, with the Harvard economists, with George Soros. There was a coupon privatization that the idea was 140 million coupons would be distributed, one to every man, woman, and child in the Russian Federation. And those coupons were good for a share of these soon-to-be-privatized state companies. Well, if you have only one coupon and you don't even know where you're going to get enough money to, to buy food, there was a black market in buying and selling these coupons on the street corners back then for hard currency dollars. So Berezovsky, Khodorkovsky, and these prospective oligarchs began buying up, like a vacuum cleaner, buying up all these coupons. And then in these corrupt privatization auctions, they were able to essentially steal state assets for pennies on the dollar. And I think someone estimated that the entirety of the Russian Federation economy through these vouchers was valued at something like $54 billion. This was a multi-trillion dollar economy of oil resources, some of the biggest oil companies in the world, of the aluminum, of gold mines and whatnot. And through the coupon rigging and the fraud around that, these oligarchs and their Western banker friends around George Bush Sr. and later around the Clinton administration were able to simply steal the state assets of the Russian people. That's the best way to understand it. It was about the value of the General Electric Company on the New York Stock Exchange for the entire Russian economy. That's what these vouchers or coupons, if you translated, would price the assets.
It's hard to even comprehend such a ripoff.
Yeah. It's just astonishing. And the forbearance of the Russian people, I've been to Russia many times as a researcher and doing interviews and whatnot over the last, since 1994. And the forbearance of the Russian people not to become bitterly anti-American after what was done to them is quite remarkable.
Could you talk a little bit about the Harvard Institute for International Development, which received, I believe you written, USAID grants? What was their role in the takedown of the old USSR?
The Harvard HIID, that you just mentioned, Institute for International Development, was a very clever scheme by former Harvard professor Larry Summers, who was now in the Bill Clinton Treasury in Washington. And Larry Summers was running the looting of the Russian Federation economy. And he sent Jeffrey Sachs, a former Harvard professor, Summers, and several other Harvard economists that worked with Summers to Moscow to set up this HIID. And the HIID later was investigated for fraud and corruption, and the Harvard University had to pay millions of dollars in fines because of that. So essentially, Harvard was used to kind of launder the destruction of the Russian economy. I think the argument would be that if you use the State Department, it would be too obvious, like the National Endowment for Democracy. You want to hide behind the skirts of a reputable university like Harvard and then do all the dirty work. So it was, in effect, this network of Larry Summers and the Clinton Treasury Department that was doing this with the USAID monies, which was a CIA front agency for the most part.
And you write about something called Open Russia, that involved Jacob Lord Rothschild, George Soros, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who you've already said got a hold of Yukos Oil, and even Henry Kissinger. What was Open Russia?
Well, Open Russia, Soros' foundation was called Open Society, and Khodorkovsky was in the process of literally buying the Russian Duma parliament for millions of dollars, you know, just bribing them to get them to change the laws on ownership of minerals, oil and gas under the ground, and also the pipeline laws that would favor the state. You know, one thing that Vladimir Putin did when he became president in 1999 or 2000 was to take concrete measures to stabilize the state organizations of oil and gas, energy, and defense, you know, to have something to work with to keep the nation from being completely looted and destroyed, turned into a casino, which is what was done under Yeltsin. So Khodorkovsky created this Open Russia Foundation as kind of his philanthropic front. And on the board of that, as you mentioned, were Lord Rothschild of London, of the famous London banking family, and also Henry Kissinger gave it a nice touch there. But when Khodorkovsky was arrested, he secretly transferred or tried to transfer ownership of Yukos Oil to Jacob Rothschild. It didn't work. The Russian courts threw that out, but that was what he was trying to do there.
Actually, how was it that Vladimir Putin was selected somehow to be part of the Boris Yeltsin government? When did that happen?
In 1998, 2 years after the election, the Yeltsin Kremlin was forced into a compromise because the Duma refused to ratify Viktor Chernomyrdin as prime minister. So to calm this opposition, which by then was getting very animated and lively, Yeltsin named a very respected outsider to head the government as prime minister, Yevgeny Primakov, a former head of the KGB foreign intelligence and former foreign minister, as prime minister. And as soon as Primakov became prime minister, he went after one of the top Yeltsin oligarchs, Berezovsky, who fled to London as a result of the arrest warrant for his involvement in an Aeroflot ticket scam. And then Primakov, when he learned that the U.S. government, the Clinton administration, was illegally bombing Serbia in March of 99, he was on a Russian jet en route to meetings in Washington. He immediately ordered the pilot to return to Moscow, and that became called the Primakov Loop. And in Moscow, he protested that Yeltsin had to intervene to support the Serbs, historical allies of Russia. And at that, Yeltsin fired Primakov, using the economy as an excuse. So it was getting very, very uncomfortable for Yeltsin at this point. He'd lost control. When NATO started bombing Serbia illegally, Yeltsin lost control of his own military. And the military ordered Russian troops to seize the airport in Kosovo, Pristina. And this was the beginning of the end of Yeltsin. If you don't have control over the military, you don't have the power of persuasion. So he fired his interim prime minister and looked for an unknown who could be manipulated, he thought, to continue the game. And that unknown was an official from the mayor's office of St. Petersburg named Vladimir Putin. Putin had little political experience and somehow was able to convince Yeltsin and the various oligarchs that Putin would be amenable to the oligarchs and their agenda, that they could do business with Putin. And that seems to have been a KGB deception operation on the part of the group of nationalists around Putin. And once Putin was appointed, he gave Yeltsin an ultimatum to resign or face real consequences for corruption and crimes. So Yeltsin resigned in December 1999 and named Prime Minister Putin as acting president until the March elections the following year. And that is the beginning of the Putin era. And until this day, the CIA and the State Department and every successive U.S. president loathes the figure of Vladimir Putin because he put a block into the complete destruction of Russia as a functioning state. He's a nationalist. That's the best way to understand it.
Now, you mentioned the war in Yugoslavia. Let's cover that next week.
Okay. That's an incredible story, as most of the stories are that I document in this book. When I finished it, I stood back from what I'd researched and put together. And even I was shocked at some of this. But that's how the fake democracy machine of the U.S. government has tried to build its power, build the one world order, new world order, Bush Senior called it.
William Engdahl, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's a pleasure to work with you and to be on with you again.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with F. William Engdahl. Today's show has been Fake Democracy: How Washington Destroyed Poland and Russia in the 1990s. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction: The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the control of oil, food, and money. He is also author of Target China: How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, and The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. His newest book, Manifest Destiny: Democracy as Cognitive Dissonance, is available through his website at williamengdahl.com. That's William ENGDAHL.com. Email him at info@williamengdahl.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaramako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today, Dr. Gabor Maté talks about addiction. Addiction is biochemical, but hard drugs don't cause addiction, he says. A hard, stressful social and economic environment affects the brain, and that causes addiction. Should we crack down on capitalism instead of cocaine? I hope you'll stay tuned. In mid-February, New World Notes marked its fourth anniversary. That's not much compared with some veteran weekly shows like Alternative Radio and Unwelcome Guests, but it's enough that I can look back at our archives and be struck by the many important subjects we haven't talked much about, and by the several important subjects we haven't talked at all about. One of these is the war on drugs, or as many say, the so-called war on drugs. Like all wars, this one is justified by several noble proclaimed goals. In this case, protecting both the individual and society from the harmful effects of drug addiction. And like all wars, the real goals here seem to be very different from the noble pretend goals that the rulers proclaim in order to persuade the people to go along with the plan. By everybody's account, the war on drugs has been a colossal, ignominious failure. And indeed it has been, for the better part of a century, and a very expensive failure. A failure, that is, if you take the professed goals at face value. Silly citizen, there's your error right there. I think the real goals are a lot more sinister than the noble professed goals. But I'm getting ahead of myself again. Dr. Gabor Maté is a Canadian physician. For several years, he has been working with what you might call hardcore down-and-out drug addicts, especially heroin addicts, in the city of Vancouver's equivalent of Skid Row. He's written a book on addiction, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Here are some of his conclusions. Drug addiction is real. Addiction is caused not by the drug, but by circuits of the brain. These brain circuits are greatly affected by the environment, especially the immediate economic, political, and social environment. The environment in the capitalist West today produces great insecurity and stress among the majority of the people. These stresses themselves have many bad medical consequences, including increased incidences of cancer, heart disease, depression, and asthma, and increased propensity to become physiologically, biochemically addicted to certain chemical substances that some other people can take without becoming addicted. The drugs have the effect of triggering hormones that reduce the feeling of stress. A lot of recordings of Maté are floating around. About the best I've found is a recent interview with Mike McCormick, host of the radio series Mind Over Matters out in Seattle. We'll hear some parts of that. We'll follow that with part of a talk Maté gave in Berkeley. Here in the interview, Maté discusses contributing factors to addiction.
When you actually look at it, you're struck by two things. One is that it's very much a condition of the brain, and you can show on brain scans and other brain studies which circuits are involved. And the more you recognize the brain function, how an automatic it is, the less you think that there's actually much of a choice in the matter. That's the first point. The second point is, if you look at what shapes those brain circuits, it's now known that the human brain develops not according to some random or strictly defined genetic program, but in fact in interaction with the environment. And if you look at the hardcore drug addicts who are, at the extreme end of the scale that I work with on the downtown east side, invariably they were severely abused children. The women were all sexually abused, many of the men were. And they all suffered neglect and deprivation in the emotional sense and often in the physical sense as well. large, significant percentage are First Nations peoples, Aboriginal peoples in Canada, who are really at the, again, the bottom of the social pyramid, politically, economically, and socially. And these early experiences actually shape the brain in certain ways that make addiction, if not totally inevitable, highly likely. And the same thing has been shown in large-scale American studies, so that in large population studies, they've shown that the most significant influence on injection drug use in adulthood is the depth and duration of adverse experiences in childhood.
In addition to being raised in an abusive family setting or lack thereof, then what other factors go into that? For instance, is stress a contributor to this?
Stress both early in life, already during pregnancy. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, their kids will be more likely to crave alcohol as adults. This has been shown in animal studies. If you stress mothers during pregnancy, as for example, a study showed during 9/11, their children will have abnormal stress hormone levels at 1 year of age. And addiction is very often a question of stress regulation. In other words, people drink or they use drugs or they engage in addictive behaviors like eating or shopping or gambling when they're stressed. So if the early stress regulation parts of the brain don't develop properly because the parents were so stressed, not necessarily abusive, but just highly stressed, that would predispose the child towards addiction later on. And then, of course, the research shows that the biggest driver, the biggest trigger for addictive relapse is stress. So that during an economic crisis like right now, predictably, a lot more people are eating junk food or people are eating more junk food because junk foods release the same chemicals in the brain that the drug addict is after, which is to say the endorphins, which is the brain's natural opiates, and dopamine, which is the brain's natural incentive, motivation, and vitality chemical. These substances are released through addictive behaviors and by the addictive drugs as well. So when people are stressed, they'll do something addictive because at that moment that'll give them some stress relief and some soothing and some of those feel-good chemicals that make them feel more balanced and less troubled momentarily. But of course, with more craving, that crops up almost right away. Again, in some families, postpartum depression on the part of the mother is a predisposition towards problems later on in life. And not because these mothers are bad mothers or abusive mothers or anything but loving mothers, but because when the parents are depressed, they can't have that quality of emotional connection with the child. Much as they love the child, they can't be as attuned to the child as they would like to be. And it was here in Seattle at the University of Washington that some years ago that an electrical encephalogram study was done of infants at 6 months of age. That's an EEG, which is an electrical readout of the neurological activity of the brain. And they compared the EEGs of six-month-old infants whose mothers were depressed to infants whose mothers were not depressed. And they could tell from the EEG of the child whose mother was depressed and whose wasn't. In other words, the child's brain is programmed by the emotional states and the quality of the emotional interaction with the parent. And this has been shown in all kinds of animal studies and human experience and so on. And so that means that what happens to us early in life is a decisive influence in shaping how we might go later on. It's not the only influence, but it's an important one. It's a crucial one. And so that's another risk factor. And then there's one more factor in our society, which I talk about in our book, Hold On To Your Kids, which is that human beings were never meant to be brought up in nuclear families. We always grew up in clans, tribes, villages, neighborhoods, communities, extended families. As the African saying goes that Hillary Clinton was fond of quoting, it takes a village to raise a child. So in the natural habitat for human beings, children are raised by a whole network of nurturing adults. Now, that's totally broken down in our society. Not only don't we have the clan, tribe, community, village, neighborhood, we don't have the extended family anymore because of economic dislocation and all kinds of stress. And the nuclear family is under such stress that both parents have to work very often to make a living. And so kids will grow up around other kids in daycares. And so that the primary connection for children very often becomes no longer the nurturing adults, but other children. And another factor that really drives addictive behaviors is the peer influence. But the peer influence is not a natural one. It's a completely unnatural consequence of social disintegration. So there are many cultural and social and economic influences that are driving addiction, but they all come down to what environment children grow up in.
But wouldn't peer influence be there in a healthy village?
No, in a healthy village, when you walk down to a village in Africa, if you're an adult, kids you've never seen before in your life will call you uncle or aunt. They relate to you like an adult because that's how they used to relate to nurturing adults. So they're not just looking to other kids for modeling and how to be in values and how to behave. They're looking to adults. And initiation in traditional cultures happens from elders, not from peers. What happens when you get initiation from peers is you get the teenage gangs. When you get initiation from adults, you get introduced into the adult culture. And so that there's tradition and security behind that. Whereas in a gang, you have nothing but insecurity. And so that's another major risk factor in North America. And if you look at the kids who are most at risk, they happen to be the minority kids in the United States whose family life have been totally disrupted by hundreds of years of history. Very often the fathers aren't around, and these kids get into gangs very early. And they're the ones who are in jail because of marijuana and cocaine problems. And so we end up punishing people for the fact that they didn't have the right conditions when their lives began.
Sticking with talking about the influence of mothers when they're carrying the babies, we would often hear things that, for instance, smoking while you're pregnant is bad.
Yeah.
Do you think the bigger contributor there is the tobacco or the situation that is causing stress that turns one towards using the tobacco?
Well, first of all, it's interesting because tobacco, of course, is a stimulant. So tobacco releases nicotine as a stimulant, like caffeine is, like cocaine is, and like crystal meth is. So the tobacco smoker is after the same brain chemical that the cocaine injector is after. It gives a momentary calm and wakes them up and all that kind of thing. Now, first of all, a significant percentage of smokers have ADHD because how we treat ADD is with stimulants like Ritalin and Dexedrine, which also release dopamine in the brain. So first of all, a lot of mothers who smoke already have an addicted problem. Number one, if they have an addictive problem, it means that they've had stressed lives. And that means that, and the smoking is one way of soothing stress. So your question is very apt. Is it the effect of the tobacco, or is it the effect of the stress? So the answer is both. You know, smoking will have deleterious effects on the developing system of the child, but so will the stresses that the mother is inadvertently trying to soothe through the cigarette habit. So it's a combination of both. And a British study showed that women who are abused by their partners, their children will have more likely to have ADHD during pregnancy. Their children will have more likely to have developmental conditions like ADD, for example. And when you look at the placenta at the time of birth, there's a higher level of the stress hormone cortisol. Now, that which makes sense because when people are under stress, they release more cortisol. Now, cortisol has a major effect on brain development and in other ways as well. So that, you know, it all comes together. You can't isolate any single factor. But what you can say is that the more stressed the environment is for a child, the more likelihood addiction will somehow crop up. And that means that in our society, with the breakdown of family and extended family and village and all that, many of us grow up under stressed circumstances to one degree or another. Most stressed are the kids who are actually abused. And they're the ones who end up in the streets with injection drug use problems and intractable ones. But again, it's a continuum.
What about situations like in your book, you write about Vietnam and veterans there who were under stress?
Well, that's a typical example. Vietnam is a typical example because the study showed that after the war, when the GIs returned, 20% of them were addicted to heroin. 20%. Now, there's this general myth that drugs cause addiction. You do a drug, you get addicted, which is, of course, scientific nonsense. And as the Vietnam experience showed, because after a few years, only 5% of those, only 1% of the GIs were addicted. So 95% of these addicts amongst them got over their addiction fairly quickly. Now, if the drugs by themselves would induce the addiction, they all should have stayed addicts. And if drugs by themselves cause addiction, then you couldn't go to a hospital and get a morphine for pain. But you can give people morphine for pain for a long time if they need it. And once the pain is gone, they quite rapidly get off their morphine so that the drugs themselves don't cause the addiction. It's a susceptibility. Now, when you look at that 1% of the GIs who stayed addicted, they were the ones who came from troubled families. And for the rest, it was the stress of the war. So now, first of all, you have to notice that out of 100 GIs, 80 didn't become addicted at all. 20 did. And for them, and for most of them, it was the specific stress of the war plus a mild susceptibility. But once they got back stateside, with the stress of the war, of a meaningless and very dangerous and cruel war, had been lifted from their shoulders, the addiction burden was also lifted from their shoulders. The small minority that stayed addicted were the ones that were highly predisposed because of what had happened to them early in life.
So do you see in other societies beyond North America, then the addiction rates are noticeably lower?
Well, I mean, a good case example is the experience of Aboriginal peoples in North America. Before the coming of what we like to call European civilization to North America, there were addictive substances here. That is to say, addictive substances that had addictive potential, such as tobacco, such as alcoholic spirits in some areas, and peyote. But there's absolutely no evidence or history of addiction on a mass scale at all, or even close to anything close to it. These substances were used in spiritual ways, in communal ways, under the guidance of elders and shamans. Now, if you look at the addiction rate amongst Aboriginal people in Canada, and I would guess in the United States as well, in our streets in the downtown east side, in our jails in Canada, for sure, you have a tremendous, disproportionately high ratio of Aboriginal people. But what happened to these people? They were dislocated from their homes. Their livelihood was denied to them. They were massacred. In Canada, at least, for generations, they were forced to send their children to these residential schools run by churches of all denominations, where they were sexually and physically and morally abused. And, of course, their natural ways of making a living were deprived from them, they were deprived of them, because of the land needs and claims of the settler population that displaced them. And they were forced into reservations, and their spiritual ways were invalidated, and now you have a huge addiction problem where in some native areas of Canada and reservations, you have an 80% addiction rate. And it's tragic, and the abuse is passed on from one generation to the next. And if you look at American statistics, the most likely to be sexually violated is a Native American woman, and 80% of the time by non-Native men. In Alaska, at least, that's true. Sarah Palin doesn't talk about that too much, but it happens to be a statistical fact. So then no wonder then that these people then, you know, find addictive substances to soothe their tremendous pain, because if you look at all the addictive substances, in one way or another, they're all painkillers. And so the central question in addiction, to my mind, is, which as I say in my book, is not why the addiction, but why the pain.
That begs the question of then, how did you get people to get off their addiction?
Sure.
That would be by stopping the pain, wouldn't it?
That's exactly right. So when you look at the war on drugs, if you had a bunch of geniuses huddled in around a situation table in some room, they say to themselves, hey, we know that the scientific evidence is clear that the biggest driver of addictive behaviors is stress. How should we help the drug addicts in our country? Let's make war on them. Let's ostracize them. Let's impoverish them. Let's judge them mercilessly. Let's criminalize them. Let's throw them into jails where there's no help for them whatsoever. Overcrowded jails where they're treated harshly. And after that, let's throw them back onto the streets. That's the way to get rid of their addiction, for sure. I mean, who would come up with such a system? But that's the system we got, for the most part. Now, of course, given that what caused addiction was a lack of nurturing and support in the first place, the solution is to nurture and support people. And so approaches that meet people where they're at, even to the extent of allowing them to use their substances under, you know, nurturing supervision, wherever that's been tried, the results are great. You know, and in Seattle, there are places where people are, it's a low threshold alcohol, you know. I think the residence is called 1811. And people end up drinking less alcohol that way. And in Vancouver, we have the supervised injection site, where people are allowed to come and bring their substances and inject. we don't give them their substances. I would like to. The studies that where we do that, they show nothing but good results. But at least they're being on substances. They inject under supervision. If they overdose, they get help. Lives have been saved. And people get clean needles and a sterile swab, so they're no longer using puddle water in the back alley to inject, but they're getting sterile water to inject with. There's less disease transmission, obviously. Hepatitis C, HIV, all kinds of other infective organisms are not passed on from one person to another. And people have the opportunity to receive some compassionate care, which is their first step towards some kind of rehabilitation. So that the real solution here is not more harsh and more punitive and restrictive measures, but actually embracing the addict at whichever level they happen to be at. Now, for some people, that might mean immediate abstinence. If that's where they're at, that's great. You just simply can't accept or expect that everybody will be at that level, and you have to bring them along stepwise. So there has to be a wide-ranging, stepwise, graded, compassionate, science-based, humane, medical and social treatment program, which we could do financially quite nicely if we didn't waste all this money on this retrograde and demonstrably, incontrovertibly worse than useless war on drugs.
How much does our society contribute to addictions from the standpoint of it being a consumer society, that we don't have citizens, we have consumers?
Well, culturally. Look at the absurdity. We point our finger at the drug addict and we say, how can you be putting something toxic into yourself that you know is going to destroy you? Then we get into our SUVs and, the kind of industries that we have that are destroying, because of our attachment to short-term pleasure and the consumer culture, we're literally destroying the earth. That's not controversial anymore, except maybe in the former White House and in Canada's current cabinet offices. But other than that, nobody with any credibility argues very much anymore that, global climate change is not a problem for us, that we're creating because of our consumerism. In other words, we live in an addicted culture, because my definition of addiction, again, is any behavior with negative consequences that we continue to crave and relapse into despite those negative consequences. What do you call the consumer culture? It's a massively addictive culture. And, of course, advertising exploits people's natural susceptibilities and vulnerabilities. And so basically the advertisement fundamentally says to you, soothe yourself with this particular product. This will make you happy. This will make you feel okay about yourself. Do this, be that, buy this, and you'll be okay for the first time in your life. And furthermore, without these things, you're inadequate. So without attainment, possession, although advertisement and the consumer culture can't by itself create addiction simply because of the messages it sends out, it powerfully hooks into people's insecurities and exacerbates them, and of course creates more social dislocation, which then feeds the addictive drive of large numbers of people. And I do talk about that issue in the book as well, just this particular dynamic of the social encouragement towards addiction.
Canadian physician Dr. Gabor Maté, expanding his focus at the end to our corporate-controlled consumer culture's addiction to gas-guzzling cars, burning every hydrocarbon we can possibly burn, and corporate growth, growth, growth. Despite the fact that in doing this, we are extremely close to destroying life on this planet. And many of the same folks who are profiting from this addiction of ours, who are encouraging us to deny that there is any problem with what we are doing, also are urging more and more war against the already abused people who are shooting up heroin in back alleyways or smoking marijuana in the park. In a speech in Berkeley this November, Maté ends on the same point I began on. Here's another way of putting it. The war on drugs has totally failed to reach its stated goals. That is obvious to everyone. Don't waste your time patiently explaining to the president's drug czar that the drug policies of the past 50 years are not working and will never work and are hurting the citizens more than helping them. The drug czar is not a stupid person. He knows that everything you're saying is true. If you're trying to inform him, What you haven't figured out yet is that the stated goals of the drug war are not the real goals. But let's let Mate have the final say here, including a final note of optimism.
And there's no war on drugs, because you can't war on inanimate objects. There's only a war on drug addicts, which means that we're warring on the most abused and vulnerable segments of the population. And we could argue left and right what a failure the war on drugs has been, because you can see that it's not working. But you know what? I have a different point of view. If decade after decade after decade, the stated intentions of our policies are not being realized, in fact, the very opposite is happening, then is it really a failure? Or maybe is it serving some purpose? Maybe it's serving the purpose of maintaining the rationale, the raison d'etre, of law enforcement and a repressive apparatus that can be used against the people when the need arises. Maybe it has the function of demonizing a certain section of the population and increasing the fear in the rest of the population that justifies more repression. Maybe it has the function of keeping a whole legal apparatus going. Maybe it has the function of making a lot of money for a lot of people. Maybe it has the function of fueling the privatized incarceration industry. So maybe, after all, it's not such a failure at all. And from that perspective, was the Vietnam War a failure? No, it wasn't. It was lost militarily, but the end result was that the U.S. still gets to control the economies of Southeast Asia. Is the Iraq War a failure? Well, it is for the people who died there, for the 500,000 Iraqis or 1 million whose lives are lost, but it's not a failure for the American oil companies. So that every war, we have to be careful before we call them failures. Somebody wins. The somebody who wins are the same people who are destroying neighborhoods and communities. It's the same system that undermines human health, that undermines human dignity, that undermines human connection, that really makes life less tolerable on our planet. Now, we don't have to agree on what the solutions might be, and that's okay. What we do agree on is the importance of speaking the truth. What we do agree on is the importance of people getting together and struggling in a healthy way for a different life. Because if it's the loss of control and the isolation and the suppression of self-expression that are the greatest causes of stress, then surely one answer to the stress of this culture is to get together and to express ourselves and not to be silent and to connect with other human beings. Or as Joe Hill said, don't mourn, organize. Thank you very much.
Dr. Gabor Mate, nicely putting the drug problem, so-called, into a broader social, economic, and political context. New World Notes is not endorsing drug use of any kind, but drug use and drug addiction are results of some very serious social and economic problems. Problems that the ruling 1% would prefer that we not think about, let alone work to solve. That's not in their interest. So that's what we need to be working on. Many thanks to Mike McCormick and to Mind Over Matters for the fine interview, and to the National Radio Project, producers of Making Contact, for Mate's talk in Berkeley. You'll find links to the originals on our drug-free and only mildly addictive website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. Illegitimi non carborundum. Don't mourn, organize, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, we're going to take a look at two different topics that our government and corporately controlled media, and some of our, quote, alternative media, are either omitting, distorting, or outright lying about, just as they did and still do concerning 9/11. And by the way, there is now so much research out there that proves beyond all doubt that the official conspiracy theory of 9/11 simply cannot be true. If you're not aware of this, please do some research. A good place to start is to read any book by David Ray Griffin on the subject. And also to go to the website ae911truth.org. That's the website of the now close to 3,000 architects and engineers who have examined the evidence. And again, that's ae911truth.org. Watch their two videos there, Blueprint for Truth and 9/11 Experts Speak Out. And that should really clear things up for you. But back to these two topics for today, which are the Parkland, Florida school shootings and weather modification. 9/11 and other false flag events are just one of the ways that we're being attacked, manipulated, controlled, and lied to. And I just don't see how we can survive and resist it all if we don't know what's happening. So let's start with the recent Parkland school shootings. And I want to say up front that I don't know what happened there. But I can tell you, just as with many of the other shootings, there's a lot of things that just don't add up. And we're going to talk about 10 of those today. And with the new media censorship, like removing videos, shutting down websites, and changing algorithms, so that online searches only take you to sites the powers that be want you to see, it may get a lot harder to learn what's really going on. James Tracy, whom I don't always agree with, but who recently wrote a very informative article called The Parkland School Shootings, Top 10 Reasons for Deeper Interrogations. So let's take a look at these top 10 reasons. Number one, missing surveillance video. Ensconced in a locale boasting a $600,000 median property value, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School is among the most modern and well-funded in Florida. Like other schools throughout the state, the campus was equipped with a comprehensive video monitoring system of buildings' interior passages and exterior walkways. The Broward County School District is withholding video taken during the February 14, 2018 mass shooting at the school that could reveal exactly how the event transpired. It appears that some video may have been obtained by the Miami Herald, which posted it with the headline, quote, "Video shows blood-smeared floor, body inside Douglas classroom." The article has since been removed from the newspaper's website. So the videos, cameras, that sounds familiar with 9/11 and the Pentagon, where all the cameras have been taken and very little has been shared of them. Number two, scripted lines. A Stoneman Douglas High School junior and ROTC member, Colton Hobb, who sought to participate in a CNN town hall broadcast on February 21st, claimed the cable network provided him with a list of scripted questions. He said, quote, "I expected to be able to ask my questions and give my opinions on my questions." Hobb explained to local ABC affiliate WPLG-TV, quote, "CNN had originally asked me to write a speech and questions, and it ended up being all scripted." Hobb said he was asked to prepare a speech and to ask about school safety and the prospect of veterans being employed as armed security guards in schools. The high schooler's ideas and queries were prohibited by CNN. After being told he had to ask a scripted question, Hobb decided not to attend the event. He said, quote, "I don't think that it's going to get anything accomplished. It's not going to ask the true questions that all the parents and teachers and students have." Number three, manufactured dissent. Stoneman Douglas High students impacted by the event were rapidly mobilized by Democratic political leaders to advocate for the party's foremost rallying cries, strengthened gun control laws. News media, including CNN and state and federal Democratic Party operatives, including Florida representatives and former Democratic National Party committee chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz, advised key Stoneman students in organizing the Never Again movement and arranging protests, including a lobbying trip to Tallahassee to meet with Florida legislators. Parkland, however, is represented by Democratic Representative Ted Deutsch, another staunch gun control advocate. And on a side note, I just want to add here that every time one of these events happens, it seems like more and more people go out and buy guns. And I was surprised to learn that many of my neighbors in rural Connecticut have guns. And one of the reasons they give for owning one is first for personal protection, but then the other reason that they say most often is that they don't trust the government. Number four, experts speak out. Those with military and school administrative experience have begun to step forward and question various troubling elements of the Stoneman Douglas shooting. For example, John Buchel, a militarily trained weapons expert, security expert, and school administrator based in Florida, tweeted at length about how Parkland differed greatly from his own experiences defending his school during an active shooter event. Number five, reports of multiple shooters. In numerous interviews, Stoneman Douglas students asserted there was more than one shooter in Building 12 as the event proceeded. Parkland student Jalen Martin claims the United States Secret Service visited the high school's campus weeks before the incident, altering the active shooter response protocol. Is this why Douglas School Resource Officer and Sheriff's Deputy Scott Peterson remained outside the classroom building as the carnage ensued? Another student claims she saw and spoke to alleged shooter Nicholas Cruz in Building 12 during the event. A Stoneman Douglas teacher told MSNBC faculty were informed there would be an active shooter drill sometime during the spring semester, but were left in the dark as to the actual date or time of the exercise. I have two comments on this one. I've actually seen the video myself on YouTube where a female student says that she was walking in the school next to Cruz, the alleged gunman, when shots could be heard in other parts of the building. She reports that there were at least two shooters. You would think that the mainstream media would be all over this. But of course, they're not. And my other comment on this section is about the drills. And we know that drills were a part of many of the violent events that we've experienced since 9/11. On 9/11, there were many drills going on similar to what actually happened. In London, during the 7/7 bombings, the real event took place in exactly the same places and at the exact same times as the drills going on that day. So when drills are involved, we need to look deeper than what we're being told. Number six, crime scene demolition. Less than 2 days after the tragic shooting, Broward County School Superintendent Robert Runcie proposed demolishing Building 12, the crime scene itself. The Florida State Legislature almost immediately agreed to help fund the teardown. One must ask why, just hours after the brutal deaths of 17 youths, plans for evidence destruction and a new memorial are even being pondered. Stoneman Douglas will join a long line of mass casualty event scenes, including Columbine, Aurora, and Sandy Hook, that have been destroyed. Sound familiar? Sounds a little bit like 9/11, where all of the evidence in New York City, all of the debris of the towers, was shipped overseas immediately, so there was no way to examine a lot of the evidence for controlled demolition. Number seven, abandoned law enforcement protocols. On the afternoon of February 14, Stoneman Douglas School Resource Officer and Broward Sheriff's Deputy Scott Peterson heard gunshots in Building 12 and rushed there, but waited outside for 4 minutes as the massacre ensued. Broward Sheriff Scott Israel, who could not explain Peterson's behavior, acknowledged Peterson's inaction was captured in campus surveillance video and suspended the deputy without pay. Israel thereafter told the press, "We're not going to disclose the video at this time, and we may never disclose the video." Two additional deputies under Israel's command, Edward Fasson and Guntis Trahia, were placed on administrative duty pending further investigation. Both deputies participated in 23 calls for service to Cruz's home and may not have followed protocol. two other Broward sheriff's deputies are under review for failing to further investigate repeated complaints concerning Cruz that may have prevented the shooting. In 2014, Peterson was selected by Parkland as School Resource Officer of the Year. Number 8, fight to establish official narrative. There's a very well-defined struggle to establish and defend the official government law enforcement narrative of the Stoneman Douglas mass shooting and prevent any questioning of this storyline. This campaign is being led in part by cable news giant and Time Warner subsidiary CNN. Alternative media have been banished from YouTube for sharing differing views and analysis of the Parkland shooting and earlier mass casualty events. A recent community guidelines policy change provides for the Google subsidiary to eliminate any videos it perceives as, quote, targeting the victims of tragedies, thus de facto censoring many important critical analyses of such events. On February 23rd, CNN directly petitioned YouTube to shut down a channel run by libertarian commentator Alex Jones, claiming that its alternative reportage and commentary on the Parkland shooting runs afoul of YouTube's policies. On Wednesday, YouTube removed a video from InfoWars page for violating its policies on harassment and bullying. CNN argued in a piece targeting, quote, conspiracy theories. CNN reporters then identified three similar YouTube videos from InfoWars and asked if they also violated YouTube's policies. The YouTube spokesman said the videos CNN sent were flagged to the policy team for review. Under YouTube's policy, if a user receives three strikes in a three-month period, their account is terminated. Such advocacy toward eliminating a media competitor and defending an official government narrative of such a controversial and still unfolding event is especially concerning. In another instance, Isaac Green, a thoughtful and popular commentator running the anti-school YouTube channel, who proffered an array of unconventional perspectives on Stoneman Douglas and political controversies, had all of his videos removed by YouTube. Shortly thereafter, Google locked Green out of his account entirely. Apparently, these people have never heard of free speech and the Constitution. We are in really serious times when the alternative voice cannot be heard and is being eliminated by the voice that represents the corrupt establishment. Number 9, FBI involvement. Ongoing internal investigations on law enforcement responses to the threats Cruz posed already reveal how the FBI, alongside local law enforcement, repeatedly failed to follow up on reports of the supposed assailant's unusual behavior, weapons ownership, and disturbing online media posts. The FBI's failure in this regard was condemned by Florida Governor Rick Scott and the U.S. Justice Department. The Bureau admitted an individual close to Cruz phoned the FBI's public access line on January 5th to report information concerning Cruz's gun ownership, desire to kill people, unpredictable behavior, and ominous social media posts. The party also stated that Cruz could likely carry out a mass shooting. The information was never forwarded to the FBI's Miami office and investigated further. Or was it? According to investigative journalist Trevor Aronson, throughout the so-called War on Terror, the FBI has been directly involved in cultivating terrorists through its network of informants and often encouraging their activities. Our nation's top law enforcement agency, traditionally focused on investigating crimes after they occur, writes Aronson, now operates more as an intelligence organization that tries to preempt crimes before they occur. But how many of these would-be terrorists would have acted were it not for an FBI agent provocateur helping them? Was Cruz manipulated to take up arms against his Stoneman Douglas peers, or was he somehow maneuvered to the scene? As observations of one eyewitness suggest, while other, more capable gunmen carried out the slaughter. And number 10, antipsychotic drugs. According to the Florida Department of Children and Families, Nicholas Cruz was receiving mental health services from Henderson Behavioral Health and accordingly taking medication for alleged psychiatric ailments. In 2016, Cruz's adoptive mother, Linda Cruz, stated that her son suffered from depression, ADHD, and autism, suggesting how Cruz was regularly consuming a cocktail of potent drugs that may have impacted his behavior and judgment prior to the shooting. The psychoactive drugs used to treat depression and ADHD have profoundly complex and potentially debilitating side effects when taken separately that are only compounded if administered in unison. These include agitation, hyperactivity, psychosis, and are further linked to suicidal and homicidal actions. Given the mass media's heavy dependence on drug company advertising, the role that psychiatric drugs may play in mass shootings is almost always downplayed in reportage on such events. The drugs aren't the only causative factor. Journalist and author John Rappaport observes, but they produce what I call the Johnny Appleseed effect throughout society. Sprinkle enough of the drugs among enough people and you get otherwise unexplainable violence popping up in schools, in workplaces. The psychiatric plague eats out the country from the inside. So again, I don't know what really happened at the Parkland School, but I think there's enough evidence out there that indicates that we may have been lied to, or that at the very least, we need to investigate more before accepting the official account of what happened there. And this article can be found on the website globalresearch.ca, posted on February 25th, 2018. And it's called Parkland School Shooting, Top 10 Reasons for Deeper Interrogation by James Tracy. And the great website globalresearch.ca is itself being attacked by the censors. And you can read about that at their website, globalresearch.ca. And now let's turn our focus to another topic that we know very little about, weather modification. To do this, you'll hear an audio clip from a 2012 interview between James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com and Michelle Chisadovsky, a Canadian professor and co-founder of the great website globalresearch.ca. This clip has been lightly edited, and here it is.
One day in Manhattan.
Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 1st of October, 2012, and today we're joined on the line once again by our old friend, Professor Michelle Chisadovsky of globalresearch.ca, all the way on the line from my home and native land of Canada. Professor Chisadovsky, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us again.
Delighted to be on the program.
All right. Well, tonight I wanted to start talking about a subject that is something that not a lot of people think of. It's not in the forefront of a lot of people's minds when we're talking about some of these events like warfare and the possibility of warfare in various parts of the globe. Something that not a lot of people have on their plate when it comes to that topic is the possibility of weather warfare and modification of the environment itself, climate, as a tool of warfare. And this is despite the fact that there's in fact a voluminous amount of detail that has been accrued over the years documenting the fact that weather warfare and climatic modification is very much a reality. So let's start talking about that. I know you've written about that extensively for globalresearch.ca. Perhaps we can talk about some of the documentation and some of the companies that are behind this climate modification agenda.
Well, first of all, I should mention that weather warfare is not something which is recent. It was used during the Vietnam War. Cloud seeding techniques which were intended to block enemy supply lines. But in the course of the 1990s, it has become increasingly sophisticated. And I'm referring to the development, what is called the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, HAARP, which is based in Gakona, Alaska, which is a system of high frequency antennas directed to the outer atmosphere, and which then can be used to trigger climatic instability in different parts of the world, as well as disrupt communication systems. We talk about NMOD, environmental modification techniques for military use. Now, these techniques of climatic modification are, if we can trust military documents and statements of the U.S. Air Force, they are fully operational. But there's absolutely no evidence. There are suspicions, of course. There's no evidence that these techniques have actually been applied. It's very difficult to actually test whether, you know, the activity of HAARP has led to particular climatic occurrences. But what is important to point out is that the United States, as well as Russia, have these capabilities, but particularly the United States, in relation to HAARP, and they have acknowledged that they intend to use these technologies of weather modification, which can trigger floods, hurricanes, droughts, earthquakes against enemies, namely, in the present context, Syria, Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, okay? And they explicitly state that these weather modification techniques have both offensive as well as defensive applications and can be used for deterrence purposes. In other words, we are in presence of something which is very diabolical. I consider this to be the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. Why? Because it can destroy the agricultural system. It can destabilize the national ecology, the environment. It can disrupt communications networks. It can destabilize an entire national economy. And in the present context of asymmetrical warfare and the use of non-conventional weapon systems, which has been proposed, in fact, by the U.S. administration, I would suspect that weather warfare is part of the agenda. Nobody talks about it. Unfortunately, scientists are absolutely mute on the subject. Scientists are mute on the subject. It is not part of the debate on climate change, although it is acknowledged that these techniques do disrupt climate. And ultimately, the scientific debate on owning the weather for military use, I'm using the terms of the U.S. Air Force. Those are not my terms. The U.S. Air Force says we must own the weather. We must own the weather so that we can use the weather for military purposes against enemies of the United States and the Western world. So that is the background.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the documents that back this up and some of the technologies that are itself doing this. And in some of your writings, you go as far back as a U.S. mathematician, John von Neumann, who was writing about this as much as 70 years ago. So this is by no means a new concept and has been fleshed out in numerous documents, as you've been detailing. Why do you think it has been so much kept under wraps, and how are they able to maintain that level of secrecy over something that's been so out in the open for so long?
Well, I think there are two elements behind this. First of all, it's the nature of the weapon system itself. It is something which is covert in its application, so that when the HAARP antennas go into full swing and trigger a particular geopolitical area of the world, okay, or a particular country, nobody knows about it. It's reported as a flood, a drought. Nobody knows about it. And it is very difficult, even for scientists, to establish a link between the activity of the HAARP system of antennas on the one hand and a climatic occurrence at the other end of the world. There have been suspicions and there have been some very unusual patterns which have emerged. So it's the covert nature of this weapon system. And one assumes it is heavily integrated into covert operations and so on. It's not strictly a U.S. Air Force undertaking. And there's always the possibility of denial. Said, oh, yes, we've been attacked by HAARP. Now, how do you prove it? But on the other hand, there have been very few scientists which have had the courage to investigate that relationship. It's a very complex relationship, namely the activity of the antennas and climatic occurrences. And the reason, as I mentioned earlier, the reason is that the scientific community is in fact more or less kidnapped by the military-industrial complex. It does not want to voice any statements which could, of course, have far-reaching implications at the political, geopolitical level. I should mention that one of the most distinguished scientists, Rosalie Bertel, who recently passed away, she brought out this relationship, but in a very cautious way. So scientists are mum on the subject matter. Environmentalists do not, although they acknowledge the existence of climatic warfare. They have never inserted that into their discussion on global warming or climatic instability. And I should mention that in effect, there was a convention signed between various countries, but specifically between Russia and China, going back to 1977, which is a convention which bans the use of environmental modification techniques and recognizes their destructive applications. And at the 1992 Earth Summit, there was a reassertion of that basic protocol of 77 in the founding documents of the United Nations Framework for Climate Change. But in effect, it was not really mentioned. And in all subsequent venues pertaining to climate change, Kyoto, global warming, the issue of environmental modification techniques for military use is never mentioned. Instead, the environmentalists acknowledge the existence of these military technologies, but they are more concerned with CO2 emissions and their impact on global warming. And consequently, the whole debate on climate change, in effect, is somewhat complicit of the military agenda.
Afghanis in Afghanistan, Vietnamese in Vietnam, Iraqis in Iraqi land, we've bombed them all. White phosphorus and napalm too, bunker busters, daisy cutters, cruise missiles, B-52s, we bombed them all. For their prosperity, their freedom and democracy.
And again, you were just listening to a 2012 interview between James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com, he does really great work, and Michelle Chesedovsky of globalresearch.ca. So as you can see, ignoring weather modification when discussing climate change is really leaving out a vital, fundamental piece of information. And without it, the climate change debate is rather shallow. And as Michelle Chesedovsky said, plays into the hands of the military-industrial complex. So please keep researching and talking about all of these topics that the powers that be don't want us to know about. As the old refrain goes, knowledge is power. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people. Power to the people. Right on.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Building Bridges brings you voices of the Shiro farm workers who have been fasting for freedom because they believe we need a fundamental shift in our nation's moral narrative, which places the lives of workers and the dispossessed at the center.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers' Fair Food Program has given workers a real voice in the decisions that affect their lives. And with that voice, they are transforming the agricultural industry where they work, eliminating slavery and violence and sexual harassment in the fields. But the fast food giant, Wendy's, has refused to support the Fair Food Program. And worse yet, it abandons growers who are doing the right thing to instead buy from an industry in Mexico, where they know sexual assault continued to thrive with impunity. And now we go to the march of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and their allies. With us now is Lupi Gonzalo, Coalition of Immokalee Workers. She is a senior staff member and leader of the coalition. She has worked in the agricultural fields of the United States for the last 12 years as a migrant farm worker, including in the harvesting of tomatoes and citrus, peppers, and many other fruits and vegetables. As part of the Fair Food Program education team, Lupe and her colleagues have conducted workers' rights education in 7 states along the East Coast. And Rachel Seary is a student at Ohio State University. She's been organizing with the Student Farm Worker Alliance for 2 years as part of the Boot the Braids campaign. I love that. Got it. Boot the Braids. That is the logo, the Wendy's child with the braids. And Rachel was one of 20 students at Ohio State University who fasted for 1 week last spring as part of the ongoing effort to kick Wendy's off campus. She is fasting again on site with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in front of the offices of Nelson Peltz, chairman and the largest shareholder of Wendy's. Translating for us is Marley Moynihan. Welcome you all to New York. And I want to begin with our sister, Lupe Gonzalo. Maybe she can explain on a day-to-day basis what it is like being a farm worker and what it is like being a farm worker woman, because a significant part of this campaign has everything to do with the issue of harassment and, indeed, ain't I a woman. Lupe?
Sí, bueno, para una mujer trabajadora, especialmente una mujer que tiene hijos, es tener que despertarse a las 3:30 de la mañana para empezar a preparar a los niños, para llevarlos a la persona que va a cuidarlos.
So especially as a farm worker woman and as a mother, many farm worker women have to get up as early as 3:30 in the morning to begin to prepare lunch and to get their kids ready to be dropped off with the woman who will be taking care of them. We have to raise our children up and take them to be cared for and then go and try to find work for the day so that we can put food on our table when we come home. And you might arrive to the field quite early in the morning, but you don't in fact go and start picking right away. You have to wait maybe until even 10 a.m., which is when the tomatoes have dried enough to be picked. And unfortunately, in addition to it having to get up very early, there are many abuses that we face regularly, such as wage theft and sexual harassment, including vulgar comments and jokes, unwanted touching, and in extreme cases, sexual assault. And for many, many years, we were not able to speak up about any of this abuse. Our voices were simply not heard, and there was nothing that allowed us to seek redress.
If you could talk about now the issue of sexual harassment, it certainly has gotten a relative degree of publicity, mostly by virtue of women in the entertainment industry, particularly women who are some of the higher paid and more prominent. Do you feel that low-wage workers and workers like farm workers have gotten the proper attention in what they faced, the kind of harassment that you've described in the fields, Lupe?
Pues ahorita, Bueno, hablando de las mujeres del campo, se está recibiendo mucha atención, sí, porque ya son más de 20 años.
Well, I can speak certainly to the question of farm workers, and I do think that the word is spreading not only about the problem, but also about the work that we're doing. We've been in this fight for over 20 years since we decided to end our silence, and today with the Fair Food Program, we've actually created a solution, and with that platform, I think, although many people didn't hear us for many years, more and more people are learning about this program that we've created that is now protecting our rights. And so since that time when we did break our silence, we had to take to the streets. We had to go and campaign. We had to protest. We had to put this pressure on these large companies in order to create this program. And so for me, the message to the women of Hollywood and to women all over that they can actually look to the struggle of the CIW and the program that we've built as a model and as a solution, because we're now bringing the solution out into the light, and it's something that they even can use in their own industries in order to affect change. And the other important thing to note is that we weren't able to do this alone. We had the help not only as farmworker women, but of farmworker men, all of the people in our community who also suffered many abuses, everything from wage theft all the way in extreme cases to modern-day slavery. And in addition to our whole community, we have the support of thousands of allies who have taken it upon themselves to pressure these corporations to join the Fair Food Program and to stand with us throughout the entire process.
I want to bring Rachel Siri into the discussion, who was part of, I love this, the Boot the Braids campaign. Talk a little bit about the Boot the Braids campaign and your interest and your support as a young person, as a young student for the farm workers, what you all accomplished on your campus and why you decided to fast for the rights of farm workers.
So the Boot the Braids campaign is actually inspired by an earlier Student Farm Worker Alliance campaign, the Boot the Bell campaign, when people were trying to kick Taco Bell off campus. And when the students were able to get the Taco Bells off campus and able to cut those contracts with those universities, it made a large impact on Taco Bell and really urged them to sign on to the Fair Food Program. And so that's the same idea with Wendy's, is if you cut their ties to some of their money-making entities, that they will feel more pressure to join onto the program. And so last year, around the same time, the OSU students had a 7-day fast. We had about 20 community members fasting every day outside of the office where our administration is. We were calling on OSU to cut their contract with Wendy's because 2 years ago they had signed an agreement in their contract that said that if Wendy's had not complied to the standards of the students, by the time that the contract rolled around again, they would cut the contract, but it was appearing more and more so that they weren't going to do that. And so we were telling OSU to keep their word and to cut their contract with Wendy's. And they would constantly bring up Wendy's code of conduct, which is a hollow document that essentially outlines what they think that the worker rights should be, but it has no accountability. It has no enforcement mechanism. They don't reveal their third party auditing system. And it didn't include farm workers in the decision-making process of how it should be made. And so we were, as we tried to explain this to them, they were not receptive to students and to the community, which is, I feel, frequently seen in college administrations. At the end of the week, they did not end up cutting their contract with Wendy's, and they ended up renewing it over the summer, of course, while all the students were away and could not lash back immediately. But this fall, we were able to have the CIW join us with a lovely Harvest Without Violence Museum, which really started to focus on this issue of sexual harassment in the field and really looked at the history of the CIW and all that it's done. And we were able to present to part of the administration and also one of the people who was on the board that decided to not cut the contract and have the CIW Women's Group share some words and explain their experiences and why they believe that OSU should join.
Exciting. And I want to go back now to Lupe Gonzalo. Tell us about why Wendy's fast food chain. Why is Wendy's the focus and how has Wendy's departed from, gee whiz, the other food chains that have come around to be responsive and how to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers?
Hemos logrado crear un programa, como dije anteriormente, que está protegiendo el derecho de nosotros los trabajadores.
Hay sesiones de educación que se hacen a los ranchos y esto es por la presión de corporaciones exigiendo que los ranchos van a...
So first, just to remind everyone how the Fair Food Program works, the reason that we are able to implement the Fair Food Program, the reason I am able to go out onto the farms to do education with workers is because all of that is backed by market consequences, by buyers who have committed to ensuring that the growers that they buy from are actually respecting workers' rights and respecting women's dignity. And so for the first time, the impact of that is that women are now able to work free of sexual harassment and free of sexual assault, which means being able to work in a comfortable environment, being able to go home at the end of the day without the weight of violence on our shoulders, to be able to sit down at a table with our children and have a calm dinner because we know that the next day we're not going to go into a violent workplace. And the only reason that all of that impact has been able to happen is simply because of the participation of these major buyers. Today we have 14 major agreements with food retailers, and at the same time we know that they didn't come on board by themselves. It really takes putting pressure on them and putting pressure on their profits in order for them to come to the table. And the Fair Food Program is implemented and monitored by the Fair Food Standards Council, which is a third-party auditing body that goes in and ensures through a complaint line and through audits that these rights are truly being implemented on the farm.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers and Allies have come to New York. They're engaged in a food fest, and they are specifically targeting Wendy's. What are the demands against Wendy's, and how do you understand why they have been so recalcitrant in responding to the Fair Food Program, whereas their competitors in the fast food industry have been compliant and actually signed contracts now? So tell us more about the fast and the actual struggle against Wendy's.
Pues a Wendy's por varios años le hemos estado ofreciendo esta oportunidad de que ellos cambien de dónde viene su tomate, la solución. Ellos tienen opción para firmar este acuerdo y ser parte de esta solución que estamos creando. Pero
Wendy's, we have been inviting Wendy's now for many years to be a part of this. They have the option every single day to decide to sign on to this program and to actually support human rights and to support the dignity of women. And so what we've seen is that Wendy's, instead of joining this program and in addition to rejecting it, they've even said publicly that they've moved their purchases away from Florida and instead are now buying their tomatoes from Mexico, where we know that women in particular still face many abuses. And so we know certainly from workers themselves who have worked in the Mexican produce industry that the conditions there are absolutely horrendous, that you start working in the fields from a very young age. And in addition to their testimony, there have been many news reports that have come out documenting the incredibly high rates of child labor and that violence against women is incredibly widespread. And so we are here demanding from Wendy's and from Nelson Peltz that they join the program and that they stop hiding behind the silence of those workers. So we are fasting for 5 days here in order to call on Wendy's to join the Fair Food Program and to stop supporting an industry in which we know that there are thousands of workers every day who are facing abuse.
Rachel, are you specifically taking part in this fast, or how do you see your role, and why are you involved in this? What does it mean to you, particularly as we are in a climate that is so rabidly anti-immigrant? We are dealing very often with people who are undocumented, who are facing tremendous oppression and castigation. Talk about your involvement and the significance of this struggle and this fast of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers Against Wendy's.
I am taking part in the fast. And I have been fasting alongside the CIW and the farmworker women this whole time. The importance of this organization encapsulates a lot. The agriculture industry as a whole has a lot of injustice within it, both to the land and to the people. And I feel like the injustice to the people is often overlooked. I also have been inspired numerous times by the work of the CIW and seeing their strength throughout all of this and their model, because this model that they've created is one that can many industries. We've seen it in strawberries to milk with the Milk with Dignity program. So really, the CIW has started this revolution in the agriculture industry of worker rights that hasn't really been seen since like the days of Cesar Chavez. And he is also a big inspiration to me and a big inspiration to the boycott with the grape boycott back in the 1960s, 1970s. I think especially in this political climate, I think people are more aware of what is happening, but there's a reason that the CIW doesn't try and create policy changes. They try and create a lasting program that transcends any one administration, because administrations ebb and flow, but also these abuses were happening even in the days of our most liberal presidents. The Florida Labor Department has three workers in it. And so even if all of the legislation is passed, that mechanism of enforcement is what is critical. And that enforcement is something that you really see when you have a worker-driven responsibility program.
We're intent on joining you, and certainly we will get sound from the demonstration by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Tell us what our listeners need to do to support our sisters and brothers, but our sisters in particular, from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, who are here to tell Wendy's that they are going to boot the Braids, that they insist that they join the Fair Food Program to deal with all of these terrible abuses.
We'll be having a march. Will be joined by nearly 3,000 people. Over 300 students are coming to New York on a series of buses that they've organized over the past month. It's called the Time's Up Wendy's March, and people from Providence, New Haven, Columbus, Cleveland, Charlotte, Tampa, Gainesville, Miami, Fort Myers, Sarasota, and Washington, D.C. will all be there. We all believe that students have a voice and students have power, and we need to help make this change. But we also believe that action is the one way to really make this change, because we can't just say these things and talk about it in rooms and meetings. We have to take action and let Wendy's know and put pressure on them and like take to the streets and have people see what we're doing and understand why we care so much. That's why we're putting our bodies on the line.
And we're going to tell Nelson Peltz exactly what, and we want to give the last word to Lupe Gonzalo. What does she want our listeners to tell Wendy's?
Pues que ellos firmen este acuerdo que estamos buscando, los trabajadores, y que se siente a pensar que
what we want people to be able to tell Wendy's is that they demand ethical practices from Wendy's, and that Wendy's respect workers' human rights, and especially that they respect the dignity of women. And also to say that we have been in this fight now for many years, and it is high time for Wendy's to join this program and to not simply be, to think about the humanity of workers and to not just continue on as a company trying to make profits without considering the humanity of the people who are harvesting their produce.
And we'll find out more, because we're certainly going to bring back sound from the demonstration. Our friends have come up from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Keep boycotting Wendy's until they sign on to the Fair Food Program and end the terrifying abuses of farm workers, the wage theft, the gender-based violence, the child labor, and indeed the slavery that occurs as Wendy's has moved away from this country to Mexico to accelerate and continue its exploitation of workers. Wendy's, enough is enough is enough. Basta ya. Lupe Gonzalo, for all that you've done for these years. Rachel Siri, for all that you have started to do and will continue. Marley Moynihan, for translating. It's been an absolute pleasure, and you are the leadership for women and for social justice and justice for all workers. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm at Donald Kahn, Michelle Pazer across the United Nations at the massive protest to get Wendy's to join the Fair Foods campaign. There are numerous signs saying boycott Wendy's and two giant cardboard cutouts of Wendy's herself and of Nelson Peltz, CEO of Wendy's.
We're going to start with a welcome by a group of women that really have stood out for always being on the side of just and noble causes. So we want to welcome the United Methodist Women. My name is Carol Barton. I lead the work in United Methodist Women for a Living Wage for All. We're members of the National Farm Worker Ministry. Some of those have been on hunger strike today in solidarity with you.
Time's up, Wendy! The women who toil in the Florida fields to harvest your produce deserve to work in a safe, respectful environment and paid a living wage.
Y que se les pague un salario digno.
That can begin by you signing a fair food agreement with their representatives. It's the right thing to do. No justice, no peace.
No justicia, no paz.
Just adding a note from our union sisters who are here in force today, that women in unions from Canada, Senegal, U.S., Turkey, Brazil, and many more march in solidarity here with you this afternoon.
You can see we are not alone, and especially with our people here that are also with us in spirit and prayer, that have been continued to support what is the campaign for fair food of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Now I'd like to invite my compañera, who is here representing the hundreds of thousands of farm worker women that work in the state of Florida. She, like myself, is originally from the state of Guerrero in Mexico. She came here at a very young age and has always been struggling to improve the working conditions. She is one like many that have not lowered their heads, instead have raise their voices to say that we are going to fight for the rights of workers. Espera por Julia de la Cruz.
Buenas tardes, ¿cómo están? Gracias por darse cita aquí. Bienvenido a todos ustedes de aquí de Nueva York y también a todos nuestros amigos y aliados que están aquí con nosotros en esta tarde.
Thanks so much to all of you for being here. To all of you who are here from New York, and to all of our other allies and friends who have come to be here with us today from so many different places.
Eso es la solidaridad.
That is solidarity.
También vamos a tener a una niña que tiene un bonito mensaje y me gustaría compartir. Ella le va a compartir con ustedes.
We also have here a girl who's going to share a beautiful and powerful message with all of you.
¿Dónde está Lisette?
Where is Lisette?
¿Y dónde están los niños de Immokalee?
Where are the kids from Immokalee?
Véngase para acá.
Y'all, come on up.
If Wendy's thinks that we're going to stop with this, they need to know that we have a future generation that is ready to continue the struggle. Many of their parents have been fasting. And not just that, but these fasters have been feeding their children and continue to make the sacrifice to feed their children and at the same time fight for justice so that their children can have a better future.
Welcome everybody to our Boycott Wendy's March. And a reason we are doing this is because we want respect for all farm workers. Boycott Wendy's. I want to start off with a new chant.
Juntos haremos la justicia con el pueblo. Todos unidos haciendo lo que es bueno. Juntos haremos la justicia con el pueblo. Todos unidos haciendo lo que es bueno.
Thank you. Muchas gracias.
For all the children from Immokalee. These children that have also, that are here also with all of their effort, but that have been able to spread the message from Immokalee with all their might. So Wendy has no exit. The next generation is ready. Because what we want is that if these children will go and harvest in the fields of Florida or anywhere else in the United States, for them to not go through what we, their parents, have gone through. For decades, thousands and thousands of women farm workers have gone through. And all her compañeras that were up here, they're an example that will no longer happen.
What we're going to do today is march like we've done in so many cities around this country. bringing our message of justice. We've done it in Miami, we've done it in Chicago, we've done it in Boston, in Columbus. We're going to be marching over to the offices of Nelson Peltz, where we've been fasting.
And so we have a longtime ally with us. So someone who comes from a family that has also been distinguished on the political scale, but also for being on the side of just noble causes. Supporting different causes all around the world through the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Center. The founder and director of the Robert F. Kennedy Center, the daughter of Robert F. Kennedy, is here with us today. Harry Kennedy.
I want to know how many people here care about farm workers.
Quiero saber cuántos aquí se preocupan por los trabajadores agrícolas.
How many people here are boycotting Wendy's?
¿Cuántas personas aquí están boicoteando Wendy's?
What is our message for Nelson Peltz? Time's up, Nelson Peltz. Time's up, Nelson Peltz. Time's up, Nelson Peltz.
Time's up, Nelson Peltz.
Are we going to be loud on these streets?
Vamos a ir con esas voces fuertes en estas calles?
Are we going to be in solidarity with these amazing farm workers who haven't eaten for 5 days? Okay, this rally is about to start, but a rally depends on voices. So let's have one cry of solidarity with the farm workers. Justice delayed is justice denied.
Justice delayed is justice denied. Justice delayed is justice denied.
Thank you.
Gracias.
¿Estamos listos?
Are you ready?
Are you ready?
¿Listo?
No los escucho.
Nelson Peltz yesterday, when we tried to deliver over 100,000 signatures from our petitions, had their doors closed to us and they had the police presence there to prevent us from coming in. Office.
Ellos son los que se esconden cuando ven a un pueblo unido.
They're the ones who hide when they see people united.
Porque nosotros los trabajadores traemos una arma más fuerte que la que él tiene.
Because we as workers have a stronger weapon than what he has.
Que es la verdad de lo que pasa en los campos donde esta corporación como Wendy's hace posible que lleguen sus tomates con explotación.
Which is the truth about the reality that exists in the fields where Wendy's is purchasing their tomatoes and there continues to be exploitation.
Así que en forma pacífica vamos a ocupar la calle Nueva York, pero antes de esto siempre lo hacemos acompañados de una bendición y hoy está con nosotros uno de, también de nuestros aliados desde hace mucho tiempo. Y vamos a demostrarle a Wendy's y Nelson Peltz que aquí estamos y no nos vamos.
So we're going to show Wendy's and Nelson Peltz that here we are and we ain't going anywhere.
Boycott!
Wendy's!
Boycott!
Wendy's!
Boycott! Boycott!
Wendy's!
Woo!
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
Six minutes and about 20 seconds. In a little over 6 minutes, 17 of our friends were taken from us, 15 were injured, and everyone, absolutely everyone, in the Douglas community was forever altered.
My name is Marlon Bundo, and I am a bunny.
My name is Wesley, said Wesley.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Trump runs his military trans ban up the flagpole. Youth take the lead in rallies against gun violence. And the gay bunny hops your way just in time for Easter. Your stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 24th, 2018. Weeks after U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis reportedly sent the conclusions of yet another Pentagon study on service by transgender troops to the president, the Trump administration issued a memo late in the evening on March 23rd that bans future enlistments by transgender recruits who might require surgery or other major medical treatment, except in certain undefined cases, and denies trans-related military health care to those who are already serving honorably. The Defense Department studied the issue during Barack Obama's tenure and recommended that the president open service to qualified transgender enlistees, which he did in 2016. Trump has systematically reversed, or has tried to reverse, virtually every other progressive Obama-era policy. As Politico noted in its early analysis, the March 23rd White House memo provides few details about how the ban will be implemented, what will happen to those who are currently serving, and under which limited circumstances transgender troops may be able to serve. It does state that the Defense Secretary Mattis will have some latitude in enforcing the policy. The memo claimed that Mattis has concluded that the policy should be adopted by the Defense Department and that the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the Coast Guard, had also signed off on the new policy. The Pentagon has insisted, however, that no policy change would be implemented until several legal challenges to the ban are resolved.
Meanwhile, Trump's Department of Justice is defying a federal court order to provide the names of the generals and other military experts with whom the president claims to have consulted before tweeting his intentions in July 2017 to ban transgender people from serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. Washington state-based U.S. District Court Judge Marshall Peckman, who's hearing one of a number of legal challenges to the ban in federal courts across the country, gave the government's lawyers until March 22nd to provide the names. Instead, the Justice Department filed papers claiming that executive privilege allows them to keep those names under wraps. Executive privilege allows the president, they say, to keep certain information confidential if it's in the public interest. Though it's hard to see what public interest is served by keeping the names, if any really exist, secret. Four federal courts have already issued injunctions against any enforcement of a ban until their respective lawsuits are settled. The issue will almost certainly require a definitive ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Swedish lawmakers voted this week to compensate their transgender citizens who are forced to undergo sterilization before their gender identity could be legally changed. That requirement was abolished by Parliament in 2013. MPs voted this week to pay the equivalent of about $27,000 to each of the estimated 700 people who were affected by that law during the 41 years it was on the books. This week's vote made Sweden the first country on the planet to compensate transgender sterilization victims. A statement issued by RFSL, Sweden's leading queer rights group, noted that money can't undo the harm of unwillingly losing your reproductive abilities, but the monetary compensation is an important step for the state to make amends to all those subjected to this treatment. Even though the European Court of Human Rights ruled last year that the practice violates human rights, 16 countries in the region, according to Pink News, still require transgender people to be sterilized before they're allowed to change their gender designation on government documents.
Applications for compensation in Sweden will be available on May 1st and must be submitted to the country's Legal, Financial, and Administrative Services Agency by May 1st, 2020.
Elsewhere, an appeals court in Mombasa, Kenya, ruled this week that the use of forced anal examinations on men suspected of being gay violates the East African nation's constitution. A lower court had upheld the practice to supposedly determine if a man has engaged in homosexual activity, but it's been ridiculed as bogus by most reputable national medical organizations, including Kenya's, and condemned by global human rights groups as torture. The ruling was a victory for the two men who were arrested in 2015 under Kenya's British colonial era law and forced to undergo anal exams and HIV testing to determine if they'd engaged in consensual sex. Those acts were punishable in Kenya by up to 14 years in prison. The two men were represented by the country's National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. The group said in a press release that the humiliation and pain caused by these useless anal examinations will follow our clients for the rest of their lives. However, we are emboldened to see our constitution at work, ensuring that all Kenyans have the right to dignity.
Kenya's High Court is expected to announce a ruling in another case challenging the anti-gay sex law itself on April 26th. The justices heard testimony from LGBT rights advocates, Christian and Muslim groups, and the Attorney General's office during 3 days of hearings in late April and early March. The government argued that decriminalization was a slippery slope that would lead to marriage equality. According to the government's own figures, close to 600 people were prosecuted for violating Kenya's anti-gay sex law between 2010 and 2014. Edwin Sisenge of the African Equality Foundation praised the Kenya court ruling that ended the use of forced anal exams. He urged the government of the UK to speak out against anti-queer discrimination in Kenya and in all of its Commonwealth countries, in order to avoid such ill and unlawful treatments of innocent gay people, when the Commonwealth heads of government meet in London in late April.
In other news, Sex and the City's Miranda, self-identified bisexual Cynthia Nixon, announced her candidacy this week for governor of the state of New York. She says she's offering a more progressive agenda than Democratic incumbent Mario Cuomo. The 51-year-old Nixon, who's won a Grammy, an Emmy, and a Tony, is currently married to Christine Marinomi, a former aide to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. The couple has a young son. Nixon says her major campaign issues will focus on failing infrastructure, government corruption, and income inequality. "I think it's time, not just in New York State, but all over this country," Nixon said at one of her initial campaign stops, "to hear from the voices of real people who understand that our government is in the clutches of millionaires, billionaires, and corporations." Cuomo dismissed Nixon's candidacy in one of his first public comments, telling reporters that, "We're in the political silly season now. I've been here before. We're in a democracy. Anybody can run. Anybody can say whatever they want to say." Most mainstream queer advocacy groups who've weighed in thus far are either supporting Cuomo, a longtime LGBT rights ally, or are staying neutral.
And finally, Ted Olson, the Republican lawyer who represented George W. Bush at the U.S. Supreme Court in the contested 2000 presidential election against Al Gore, but who joined his liberal opponent in that case, David Boies, to successfully challenge California's marriage equality-denying Proposition 8 in 2013, was offered a job on Donald Trump's legal defense team this week. Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway reportedly recommended the hire to the president as his agitation grows over looming investigations into his financial empire and ties between Russia and his presidential campaign, and as he scrambles to line up worthy adversaries to Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. Though Olson himself declined comment, he only took a day to make a decision. A terse media statement issued by a spokesman for the litigation group in which Olson is a partner simply said that, "I can confirm that Theodore B. Olson will not be representing Trump."
That's News Wrap. Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending March 24th, 2018, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
My name is Sawyer.
My name is Andrea.
And we are survivors from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and we also wrote the song Shine.
This song is not only dedicated to the 17 and 14 injured, the 17 victims that we lost, it's dedicated to all their friends and family, and to anyone who's ever experienced gun violence.
Together, we are going to be the change. We are going to change the world. Thank you.
We refuse to be ignored by those who will not listen. We deserve to feel safe in our own schools. The time for change is now.
The smallest of words can make the biggest difference.
Be the voice for those who don't have one.
Together, we have the power to change the world around us.
A new generation of activists shines from Washington, D.C. to cities around the world on March 24th in coordinated mass actions demanding an end to American gun violence. Close to a million demonstrators crammed the National Mall in response to the call issued by students from Parkland, Florida's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, the scene of the most recent mass shooting. It may have been a first for the young rally organizers, but there were constant reminders of their movement predecessors, including one of the 11-year-olds who addressed the rally crowd.
I have a dream that enough is enough. And that this should be a gun-free world, period. Will you please repeat these words after me? Spread the word! Have you heard? All across the nation.
More than a pep rally, speakers like Stoneman Douglas Jr. Alex Wind emphasized a clear strategy to pressure lawmakers for change.
For too long, our government has been useless on this issue. Our job as their constituents is to make sure we know what they're thinking. There are over 250 representatives that have not come out with a public stance on this issue. It is our job to make sure that we call them up and force them out of the shadows of corruption and into the light of justice. Now, we need to come together on all fronts and push aside those that divide us. Now we need to get on the phone and call our representatives and push them to stop incumbency and take action. Now we need to educate ourselves on which politicians are truly working for the people and which ones we want to vote out. It is not about your race. It is not about your sexual orientation. It is not about your ethnicity. It is not about your gender. It is not about where you live or how much money you make. And it most certainly is not about political party. All it comes down to is life or death. To all the politicians out there, if you take money from the NRA, you have chosen death. If you have not expressed to your constituents a public stance on this issue, you have chosen death. If you do not stand with us by saying we need to pass common sense gun legislation, you have chosen death. And none of the millions of people marching in this country today will stop until they see those against us out of office, because we choose life. Thank you. I love you all.
The most powerful speech of the day was the one that used the fewest words. After calling out the spirits of her lost schoolmates and teachers, Stoneman Douglas Gay Straight Alliance President Emma Gonzalez stood in almost uncanny dignity for an extended silence, representing the length of time it took for them to be killed. Interrupted only occasionally by the hushed crowd of hundreds of thousands of people with shouts of support, or by Emma's sniffling.
6 minutes and about 20 seconds. In a little over 6 minutes, 17 of our friends were taken from us, 15 were injured, and everyone, absolutely everyone, in the Douglas community was forever altered. Everyone who is there understands. Everyone who has been touched by the cold grip of gun violence understands. For us, long, tearful, chaotic hours in the scorching afternoon sun were spent not knowing. No one understood the extent of what had happened. No one could believe that there were bodies in that building waiting to be identified for over a day. No one knew that the people who were missing had stopped breathing long before any of us had even known that a code red had been called. No one could comprehend the devastating aftermath or how far this would reach or where this would go. For those who still can't comprehend because they refuse to, I'll tell you where it went. Right into the ground, 6 feet deep. 6 minutes and 20 seconds with an AR-15, and my friend Carmen would never complain to me about piano practice. Aaron Feist would never call Kira Miss Sunshine. Alex Schachter would never walk into school with his brother Ryan. Scott Beagle would never joke around with Cameron at camp. Helena Ramsey would never hang out after school with Max. Gina Montalto would never wave to her friend Liam at lunch. Joaquin Oliver would never play basketball with Sam or Dylan. Elena Petty would never. Kara Lugren would never. Chris Hickson would never. Luke Hoyer would never. Marquin Duque Aguiano would never. Peter Wang would never. Alyssa Alhadaf would never. Jamie Guttenberg would never. Meadow Pollock would never.
Since the time that I came out here, it has been 6 minutes and 20 seconds. The shooter has ceased shooting and will soon abandon his rifle, blend in with the students as they escape and walk free for an hour before arrest. Fight for your lives before it's someone else's job.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody, this is Leah Delaria, and you are listening to This Way Out.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence's family has a pet rabbit named Marlon Bundo. His daughter Charlotte wrote a children's book about the bunny called Marlon Bundo's A Day in the Life of the Vice President. Proceeds are being donated to charity. John Oliver, host of HBO's Last Week Tonight, spent about 20 minutes of his latest show detailing Mike Pence's anti-queer history, which is long and ugly. Oliver focused on Pence's decades-long close relationship with uber-Christian evangelical James Dobson, founder of Focus on the Family, which still includes claims on its website that a homosexual orientation is curable. Oliver's lengthy indictment led up to the announcement that he was publishing a parody children's book of his own called A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo, in which the main character meets and falls in love with another male bunny. The vice president himself seems to have inspired the villain of the story. Oliver's book launch included a beautifully animated excerpt from the audiobook version that's available at audible.com. Along with the voices of Jeff Garland, RuPaul, Ari Kemper, and Jack McBrayer, it stars Jim Parsons, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and John Lithgow.
Hello, my name is Marlon Bundo, and I am a bunny. This is the story of my very special day. As usual, after breakfast, I hopped to the garden to look at the flowers. That is when I saw him. The most beautiful bunny I had ever seen. My name is Marlon, I said, but my family calls me BOTUS. It's short for Bunny of the United States. It's a long story.
My name is Wesley, and my family calls me Wesley,
said Wesley. We went on a long hop together. We hopped through the garden. We hopped right inside the old stuffy house. We hopped through very boring meetings with very boring people. At the end of our hop, I said, Wesley, I don't want to hop without you ever again. And Wesley said,
That's funny, because I never want to hop without you, Marlon Bundo, ever again.
And we both said,
We will get married and hop together forever.
Said the stink bug.
You can't get married!
The stink bug was in charge. All the animals listened to him, even though he was very stinky.
Boy bunnies don't marry boy bunnies. Boy bunnies have to marry girl bunnies.
But don't worry, we had a plan. A plan that involved all the animals in the garden.
And if you want to know how the story turns out, you are going to have to buy the book. Please, buy it for your children, buy it for any child you know, or just buy it because you know it would annoy Mike Pence.
Proceeds of Oliver's book, which was written by one of his staff writers, Jill Twist, are going to the queer youth suicide prevention group, the Trevor Project, and the HIV support group, AIDS United. It quickly leaped over the Pence book to become the number one bestseller on Amazon. A shocked John Oliver quickly announced that an unexpected second printing was underway. The obvious anti-Pence flavor didn't prevent daughter Charlotte from buying Oliver's book. She told the Hill newspaper that he's giving proceeds of the book to charity, and we're also giving proceeds of our book to charity, so I really think that we can all get behind it. Before we all get warm and fuzzy, the stops along Charlotte Pence's promotional book tour include the Colorado Springs headquarters of Focus on the Family.
We have cleared off the table, the leftovers saved, washed the dishes, and put them away. I have told you a story and tucked you in tight. At the end of your knockabout day, as the moon sets its sail to carry you to sleep over the midnight sea. Well, I will sing you a song no one sang to me. May it keep you good company.
You can be anybody that you want to be. You can love whomever you will. You can travel any country where your heart leads. And know I will love you still. You can live by yourself, you can gather friends around, you can choose one special one. And the only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're gone.
Oh, the love you leave behind when you're gone.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Francis O'Brien and Seth Eric Cutler, with thanks to Steve Pride, the Stoneman Douglas Drama Club and Student Choir, Jennifer Hudson and the DC Choir, Ray Anthony and his orchestra, and the Flirtations performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org and on 2XX Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, WORT Madison, Wisconsin, KRUX Las Cruces, New Mexico, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station, where our big birthday bash is just around the corner. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The cowboy brings to mind so many of the things we don't like on the left and which are valorized in American myth-making. But what if the image of the cowboy, and the West more broadly, as a stand-in for capitalism and American empire, are wrong? In The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West, published by Verso, Mark Laws argues that we need to see the cowboy as an exploited worker in a West marked by the consolidation of big capital, the extermination of the native population, and a state that often used the same armies to slaughter native peoples as to put down labor unrest. Laws is professor of history at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Cincinnati and the author of scores of books including Race and Radicalism in the Union Army. Mark, what place did the cowboy in fact play in the social order of late 19th century America?
There was a series some years back by Tony Robinson called The Worst Jobs in History on the BBC. If you had an American version of this, the cowboys would probably be the first episode in terms of the worst job. It was the very bottom of the class structure in some ways. They were migratory labor for the most part. They were overwhelmingly young, terribly underpaid. If you were working as a cowboy on a cattle drive, one of the big issues over wages, for example, is they're talking about maybe $30 a month, which is unbelievable considering that the workday was 12, 16 hours a day, and maybe part of the day on Sunday. They worked incredibly long hours for very little in terms of money, very little in terms of prospect, of course, no job security. And when the entire job was over, they were hundreds of miles away from home in terms of the cattle drives. The better position among the cowboys would be to have a permanent job on a ranch, and that was something that only a fraction of them could actually were actually lucky enough to have. You need the most work to do this sort of thing if you're going to move those large herds. That's when you really get the larger number of people becoming cowboys. There was a tremendous amount of turnover, and that's one of the things that allows for a kind of mythologizing of the cowboy. The people who were actually doing this would be doing other jobs. They were farmhands. Some of the people that you encounter in the book, for example, were working on the railroads as well, or you might work as a miner or a prospector. And being a cowboy was what you did when you didn't really have anything else to do. My impression is that very few of these people, after the first cattle drive, were ready to go on another one.
So then the reality of the cowboy was as a wage worker whose work was pretty precarious. That contrasts quite strongly with the image of the cowboy as this representative of rugged individualism, almost the idea of this person who's independent and really not dependent on the larger social system. Why is the contrast so stark?
Well, there's a myth about the cowboy, and in some ways it's the epitome of the myth about the American worker, and that is that if you take a job, even a terrible job, you work hard at it, you know, you stay sober, keep your nose to the grindstone, and eventually you'll be able to pull yourself into the middle class. Cowboys probably had a better chance of doing that, but for a very, very small window of time. At a certain point, that opportunity fades very quickly. But in the early days, when they really began the cattle industry, before the beef bonanza really reached its peak in the later 70s and early 80s, you have a period of the open range. And the open range meant that you had a lot of horses, a lot of cattle that were unbranded and roaming around, mavericks, as they would call them. And if you were a cowboy, even if you were at the time working for someone else, you could grab an unbranded horse with some unbranded beef on the hoof and cart it off, if you had a place to put it, a little, you know, homestead off on the side, and eventually build yourself up a little herd. And as most circumstances like that, you can attain a kind of a middle-class status if you have property and can start running your own business, but it's never going to last. You'll be run out of business by the big ranchers very easily.
Well, let's talk about the wider world that the cowboy operated in. And when you said the 70s and 80s, you're talking about the 1870s and the 1880s.
Yes.
So I wonder if you could talk about how, in the late 19th century, how the West was not just won, as the expression goes, but as you argue in your book, was made and remade. Tell us that story of white settlement, native displacement, extermination.
Depending on where you look in the West, it could happen very quickly. That's one of the surprises I had when I started really looking into this. In American history, the sort of founding idea in American history was the Turner thesis. You know, Frederick Jackson Turner, 1893, the time of the World's Fair in Chicago, he delivers this incredibly influential paper called The Significance of the Frontier in American History. And he attributes to the frontier the development of democratic attitudes and rugged individualism, all of the sort of things that sort of become part of that mythology of the West. The last few decades, scholars have looked at this very differently. And while they see the West as playing a very important role in this entire process, the West is really a legacy of conquest. It's a legacy of ethnic cleansing. It's a legacy of a very rapid transformation of the environment. If we think of the 70s and the 80s nationally, it used to be known as the age of the robber barons, right? It's the Gilded Age. There's nothing to counter that in the West. If you go east, there are different kinds of sort of bourgeois interests that have to reconcile themselves, large landowners, railroad owners, manufacturers, mining, all sorts of things. In the West, these big companies can come out there and really gain a rather rapid control over everything. The large ranchers in parts of Texas, for example, or Kansas or Wyoming or Montana, anywhere in the plains, they can have an almost oligarchic control over what happens to people. They get this rather quickly. In the Texas Panhandle, where this strike occurs in 1883, for example, the native population is basically pushed out in a series of wars waged by the U.S. Army, assisted by Texas Rangers, in the 1870s. They're exterminating the buffalo at the time. They're also getting rid of the Indians, and they're going to replace them with longhorn cattle, domestic longhorn cattle, and a new human population as well. And all of that really happened so quickly. By the time you're in the early 1880s, some of these large ranchers, they have land the size of a county. They represent capital that comes from places like Chicago, New York, of course, but also London, Glasgow. This is sort of international capital coming into the West, because there was so much money to be made from beef at that point. The thing that changes this so quickly, to go back to the sort of national picture of the robber barons, the archetype, I guess, of the robber barons are the railroads, right? They're the great villains in the entire piece. Understandably, in some ways, as the railroad comes in, they change just about everything. Suddenly, you're not the homesteader off on your own little plot of ground somewhere, getting enough food to feed yourself and your family, and maybe selling a little something in town for taxes and clothes, medical, whatever you might need in terms of the money economy. Now you are competing, if you're growing corn in Kansas, with people who are growing corn in Illinois or upstate New York. It's now creating, the railroads are creating a national market for these things. And it accelerates this process where the large concerns can swallow the small concerns. It's often said that there were more farmers in this period we're talking about, someplace like South Dakota, than there are today. And it's simply because the larger farms swallow the smaller ones. The development of technology in agriculture does that. But not just agriculture, of course, any of these industries we talk about. The three great industries that seem to dominate the West piecemeal, the railroads, of course, mining, which, depending on where you're looking at in the West, you've got copper, lead, gold, silver, have tremendous control. Virtually company towns are invented because of their power. And then you have this situation in terms of the beef bonanza, the big cattle barons. This is really something that comes out of Texas, and it comes out of post-Civil War Texas. The Reconstruction in Texas is resolved, of course, violently. I don't want to say it's not resolved politically, because that is a way that you could politically resolve something, I suppose. But it's not resolved by the ballot. In Reconstruction in Texas, the Republicans that come to power after the Civil War basically are trying to change the way the state functions. And all of the old leaders of the state, all the old big money in the state, the law enforcement mechanism, they try to get rid of the Texas Rangers and replace it with the Texas State Police. These are going to be disproportionately African Americans, for example. And it's going to create an ongoing series of violent confrontations that take place in Texas. It's not an accident that the enforcers for this new oligarchy that's emerging in the West are going to be hired guns from Texas. This is a place that they get their training.
So how then, mapping on to the picture you're painting for us of the changing political economy of the West, the concentration of capital, large ranches, the railroads and their expansion, mining. How does this then change the workforce? Who is the workforce? And what sort of conflicts start brewing of the kind you're just alluding to?
Well, it's very interesting, the workforce, isn't it? We were talking before, you know, about creation of this new kind of hierarchy. It's also, of course, going to be a racial hierarchy, isn't it? And what happens in the restructuring of the economy is that certain groups are going to get marginalized. Certain are going to be kept at the bottom. And some are going to be assimilated into a strata within a working class. In the case of the cowboys, for example, most of these people are going to be, I'm talking about the panhandle now. In East Texas, it seems like a majority of the cowboys are African Americans. In the valley, a majority of them tend to be Hispanic. When you go up into North Texas, you go up into the panhandle, the areas that are moving those large herds to the railheads in Kansas, the ones that are closest to that. Oh, these are going to be younger guys, younger white guys who are in their early 20s, mid-20s. They're not old enough to have been in the Civil War. They were probably children. They may be the sons of veterans or whatever, but no real connection to the Old South. They're almost like the displaced persons of the Civil War. So they can sort of be, this is how they can fit into this whole process. If you have the Milton Friedman way of looking at sweatshops, he used to say, well, it's not really a sweatshop. It's how these people actually get to fit in and make money out of capitalism. You could say that same thing, I suppose, about the cowboys.
That's the voice of Mark Laws. He is the author of The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So this period that you are talking about, the period of the robber barons, of the really rapid conquest of the West and transformation of it, is also a period of great social strife, of unrest, and then of great violence. Violence is a theme that runs throughout your book, The Great Cowboy Strike. Can you tell us broadly, before we focus on the cowboys themselves, about the kind of labor unrest that was taking place in the United States in the 1870s and 1880s?
Well, there were all sorts of labor organizations that were developing. The one that was the largest and probably the most important were the Knights of Labor, which was a secret order, reached about 750,000 in terms of membership. It was part of a number of these associations that were expressing the class tensions of that period. When I was conceiving this book, I was thinking of how I could talk about the question of class formation in relation to traditional Western themes like range wars, and also to the ignored dimension in terms of insurgent politics. Insurgent politics come out of these associations, and they're inseparable from labor struggle. We have the patrons of husbandry, which emerged in the 1870s in the upper Midwest, becomes incredibly large, several million members. You have the Industrial Brotherhood, which is sort of the godfather of the Knights of Labor, comes out of the Grange in southwest Missouri. The Industrial Brotherhood wanted to organize workers as well as farmers, and coming out of a southern state in the process of Reconstruction, they also wanted to organize blacks as well as whites. So the Industrial Brotherhood is often neglected in this. Later, you have the Farmers Alliance, another mass organization. But these aren't just sort of social orders. They have an agenda, even when they don't think of themselves as being overtly political. Their arguments, what they want to see happen in the society, are a range of essentially political demands. And the very fact that they form and they take root and they become so large, it's a good reflection of those sort of social tensions that exist in the West. You have everywhere in America, you have the old agrarian dream, right? Where you think that you can move out of a big city, get your little farmstead in Nebraska, and become a successful small businessman, growing corn and being successful as a landowner. It really doesn't happen like that very often. But they don't give that up without a fight. And in a sense, from the 1870s through the 1890s, that struggle over what the future of the country will be, what the future of the West will be, is a struggle over the future of the country. Large business concerns, big businesses,
whether we're talking about rail, mining, or even the cattle industry, they'll put a lot of money into these enterprises as long as they get a profit out of it. Once it's not profitable, they just go somewhere else. And so it's not as though these folks are actually investing in the development of the West. They are absolutely central to the development of the West, but for them, it's simply a place they're making money out of at any point in time. So there's a tremendous ground for social organization, social discontent among farmers, among people, well, certainly among the groups that are sort of the outcast groups in all of this. We think of the situation of African Americans in Texas or Arkansas or Missouri, Native peoples, of course, Chicanos, Hispanics in the Southwest, later on the Chinese. All of these groups are going to play a very important role in terms of the West, and it's going to make the West, in some ways, it's going to make the West more characteristic, a more interesting place to look in terms of understanding race than the rest of the country, because you have all these different factors involved.
Well, tell us more about that and the degree to which, as people were struggling around the issues that were directly facing them, some of them were racial in nature, some of them were class, and some of them were a combination of the two. To what degree did the organizations that were springing up see the need to link arms across racial difference, and how much, to what degree were racial differences really sort of an insurmountable factor in creating broader solidarity?
It kind of depends on when and where. Most of the West had a real problem in terms of the Chinese, partly because the Chinese were brought over as contract labor early on, and they were generally from that point on seen as simply contract labor. They were people who were underwriting wages, and so it wasn't at all true. After a certain point, they're basically in the same mix with everyone else. What I found when I was looking at the cowboys, and I think this is probably true of the American workforce in general in the 19th century and in places well into the 20th century, and right up to the present in places, is that you basically have a workforce that's ethnically stratified. So the question of interracial solidarity or even interethnic solidarity often simply doesn't come up, even when it should come up. Different groups have control over different occupations, right? So, say, in this period, for example, there are reasons why the Irish are viewed as, you know, as the quintessential policeman is an Irishman, because the Irish were here at a time when the police forces were organizing. They were the base of the democratic machines, and giving them a job in the police department was would meet the need to consolidate their relationship to the machine, and at the same time, they would have control over that. Other places, furniture making in New York is going to be done by Germans at a certain point. And so, you know, that kind of process is sort of part and parcel of how you make an American workforce. And it happens in the West, too. There's that kind of ethnic stratification. Now, you get into some interesting problems when you're dealing with something like a new industry, like the cattle industry during the beef bonanza. The original signers of the call for the cowboy strike, 23 names, and two of them are Hispanic, and that kind of indicates indicates that there's some openness to the idea of solidarity beyond white workers. There are elements, there are cases when you're looking at the panhandle where you find blacks working in the industry, but they don't generally work as cowboys. They'll work as cooks. They'll, you know, work as kind of mid-management at times, but cowboy is a different matter, especially going out on the cattle drives. I think I found one instance where someone had done that, and I'm sure that people who do study, you know, the cattle drives a little more closely may have encountered this, but it doesn't look to me as though there was a great deal of mixing in that.
How did
the organizations, I said the Industrial Brotherhood and certainly the Knights of Labor, advocated solidarity. And how well they did or didn't do with that probably depended on where you look.
How did cowboys organize themselves when they had grievance? And was there a tradition of radical organizing amongst cowboys? Did it come from more spontaneous acts? What did you turn up?
It's the rumor was always that there were organizers. Whenever you have trouble, you blame secret organizers, right? Sure. There's talk of there being anarchist cowboys after Haymarket in Chicago, for example. I don't doubt that they had that anarchist newspapers, socialist newspapers, radical agrarian newspapers were being read by cowboys. And there may have been some connections here and there. But in terms of the actual labor strife, cowboys had no real power except on those at the onset of a drive. Basically, the large ranchers, if you're going to try to get your herds together, get them organized, get the food together to support people on the road, get the workforce together and get them north, you're on a timetable that's kind of rigid. You have to start, if you get your cattle to the railhead late when they've already been buying cattle, your price is going to be lower. And you can't start too early because the rivers will be flooding in the spring, right? So you have to get going at just about the right time. And this gives cowboys a period of a few days, a couple of weeks, where they actually have tremendous power because you're really off in the middle of nowhere. You don't have large towns. You don't have a workforce that you can, you know, hire to replace strikers or anything like that. You've got what you've got. And if they suddenly decide, as they did at times, where they're not going to cooperate, they're just not going to go on the cattle drive unless the following demands are met. And it usually has to do with wages. So the cowboys can then act, and if they act quickly, and if they stick together, they can win. The strike that the famous 1883 strike in Oldham County up in the Panhandle, this was one that the sort of call for the strike meetings signed by 23 people. According to the other accounts, it grows, and depending on the time you're looking at it, it reaches to where you're talking about several hundred people involved. And that may not sound like much, but that's, you know, the majority of the adult male population in the county. So the strikes can become very, you know, they can take off. Once that happens, once you have that many people involved, the owners are going to give in. They will agree to anything in order to get their cattle on the road and meet that timetable. Now, the problem is, in terms of a permanent organization, that they will probably not hire back the ones that they view as troublemakers, right? So that you might get good pay this year, but next year it's going to be a totally different situation. There was at least one assembly listed in the Knights of Labor in Colorado, I think it was, that described the composition of it as cowboys. And there certainly were cowboys who were connected with the radical so-called Black International, the Red International. There were cowboys associated with them. The most famous of them was probably Bronco John Sullivan. Bronco John was from Wyoming and went out on his own very early in life, wound up becoming a scout for some of these cattle drives in Texas. And he actually winds up doing his own Wild West show. So he's a rather interesting character. He winds up touring the East during the 1880s. It's not unusual if you look at the old newspapers that there's a Wild West show and you see that Bronco John is there. He might very well give an interview with the newspapers in which he's going to spout all sorts of Knights of Labor arguments. He meets in Cincinnati. He meets Karl Marx's daughter. And her husband, and I think Wilhelm Liebknecht was with them. The local German socialists took them down to a Wild West show when they were visiting Cincinnati. And here was Bronco John talking about capitalism to the 20 cowboys around the stage who had just shown up, done their little show with their costumes, and then were sitting around griping about politics. So there were organizers. There were people who were playing an important role in all that. The thing is, in terms of most of the backdrop of all of this, of course, is that the labor in this period
was subject to really severe repression most places. If we think of something like the 1877 railroad strike, which reached into the West, this is in the wake of the panic of 1873, the railroads basically decided they would continue to pay dividends and so on, mostly by announcing pay cuts on non-management employees. So they did this and got away with it 1 year. Then they did it again, and they kept doing it. And it really forced the workers to respond in ways that they might not have ordinarily done. So in 1877, when this happens, and famously in the case of Martinsburg, West Virginia, the workers go home, get their Second Amendment devices, and come back to the railroad roundhouse, barricade themselves in, and put an end to the train traffic going through there that day. Once that happens in a few cities, it spreads up and down the line. And the way that the railroad owners dealt with this immediately is that they went to the government. They went to the city governments, went to the state governments. Ultimately, they went to the federal government. There was a famous case in Chicago in 1877 where the U.S. cavalry, coming back on freight cars from the West, still dusty from chasing the Sioux Indians. Remember, this is right after Custer, the Custer massacre the previous year. And they come back into Chicago, bring their horses off of these trains, mount up, and then they're attacking the immigrant crowds in Chicago. There's a great deal of violence in terms of the repression of labor discontent in this period. And the problem is that when the employers get to do what they want, they always want to do more. So even if they're successful, it's not as though they're stamping out labor discontent. It just means that they're going to be doing something even worse to create next year's labor discontent. So the Gilded Age is a period where there's a great deal of sort of labor violence all around the country. In the West, it's different because basically, these people have, as I was saying before, it's not a pluralistic ruling class that you have. They're very much controlled by rings, by political machines, by a few big industries or even a few big employers. If we take the case of Wyoming with the Stock Growers Association, they simply run the place. The same with Montana, where Teddy Roosevelt became famous as a rancher.
And it also sounds like, as you just illustrated, that the violence of conquest, of racial violence, then bleeds over into labor violence, violence against workers who might be white or they might be other races, and that, you know, that generalized violence from the state kind of linked up with capital is a hallmark of that era.
Yes, and I think, if we think about Texas, that's sort of the school for this sort of thing. When we talk about range wars, if you look up range wars, right, most of what you're going to be seeing, not all by any means, are, you know, very famous cases outside of Texas, but Texas seems to have them recurrent, and they're just going on almost continually. And this is a legacy of what happens after Reconstruction, where you basically got the struggle of the old white redeemer governments, the Democrats coming back into power after the Civil War, the old Confederate elite, there might be one way of thinking about them, they're coming back into power, and they're trying to crush out all the institutions that the Reconstruction had put in place. And part of that was the idea of having armed black law enforcement officials in the state. So, yes, the training ground for violence, when we talk about something like the Johnson County War, 1892 in Wyoming, this is where the Stock Growers Association is basically putting together a list of people they want to get rid of, and they're hiring gun thugs to come up and do this for them. And they are Texas-hired guns. The reason they're Texas-hired guns is that they are products of that conflict in Texas.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West. His name is Mark Laws. He's professor of history at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Cincinnati. And his many books include Free Labor, The Civil War, and The Making of the American Working Class. So tell us about the cowboy strike wave that took place in the mid-1880s. In 1883, there was the strike in the Texas Panhandle. What happened after that, and to what degree were the strikes connected?
I think it's hard to tell. The trouble with cowboy strikes is that they're taking place where there aren't a lot of big towns. There aren't a lot of big towns with newspapers. So you're sort of left to do a lot of reading between the lines. It's a great detective story, though. You're going to get most of what you're going to get in the newspapers are going to be what the employers are telling the newspapers. The problem is they don't always tell them the same thing. So you get little glimpses, little windows into it. The 83 strike is usually seen as the first one. There's some indication that there was an earlier strike in Kansas, which may or may not have been the case. It's hard to say. But the 83 strike was certainly the first really big one. And it's often described as a tremendous failure in the newspapers. It was not. It was a sterling success. But it makes sense that if you're an employer, that you would want the story to go out that this was completely crushed and that all the men lost their jobs. And everybody was miserable, and the cattle walked themselves up from Texas to the railheads in Kansas. That's not what happened. There are a few counts that come through that talk about a successful strike, and I think it was almost surely a successful strike. I say that the people don't go on these cattle drives unless it's they don't really have any other options in terms of employment that season. But, of course, some of them that don't have options are going to come back. So people who show up in the Texas cattle drives, for example, they're going to show up all over the West. Some of them at the end of the drive, they're up in Kansas. They may continue to another point in the West. They may go out to Colorado. They might go up to Wyoming. Wyoming, of course, is just full of Texans at this point. And that is because they were the people who really pioneered in terms of the beef bonanza. The beef bonanza comes to an end due to some really rough climate crises in the late 1880s. Had some very bad winters and blizzards that 88, for example, you have a blizzard across much of North America. What happens in terms of the cattle industry was just a disaster. They put up fences, which means, of course, that if you have a really terrible winter, unlike the buffalo, the cattle can't migrate south because of the fences. So people lost a third to half of their herds in these terrible winters. They basically were making so much money out of raising cattle that they really overinvested, and they had too much cattle. They were overfeeding, overgrazing the land, and they were just going to have a problem with that at some point anyway. But what happened is in the late 80s is it created such a crisis that the big ranchers were all going out of business. And they had to make a decision at that point as to whether they, who was responsible for that, their own stupid business decisions or those overpaid cowboys. So what we wind up with in the late 80s with the fence cutter wars in Texas or in into the 90s and something like the Johnson County wars, the large stock growers are essentially going after the small owners, going after their workforce, trying to employ the kind of social control in the West that they can get away with in the West. They really couldn't get away with quite as easily someplace like Homestead, Pennsylvania or Pullman, Illinois, or anywhere in the East with newspapers and journalists. What happens in the West is that you have this wave of violent repression that accompanies the end of the beef bonanza. Now, the cowboys aren't in any position, I guess, as cowboys to respond to this, but you get some of these folks, some of these individuals that go off and they wind up getting jobs on the railroad or they go into mining or they do other things. And essentially, they sort of maintain the lessons that they learned. in that process. The one big strike you think of in this period in terms of the railroad was the Southwestern strike. When you look at the Southwestern strike, this is one that the Knights of Labor did in the 80s. When you're looking at the struggle around Fort Worth, for example, the newspaper descriptions of it, it's almost like a shoot 'em up scene from a cowboy movie. Both sides wound up armed, and they, you know, it was a losing battle in some ways. But the people who were involved in that strike, for example, or in the Johnson County War, were also taking those mass organizations with the political demands, and were taking their case into politics, taking their grievances, taking their demands into politics. So you have a wave of greenbackism, union labor parties, the populist party ultimately. Populist seems to be a bad word today. I don't know how that happened, but, you know, often words get misdescribed over time. The populists were the people's party that advocated putting people before profits. The Socialist Party, when you get a Socialist Party in the United States, basically comes out of the populists. And the populists reflected those sort of broad concerns, lower middle class, laboring class, particularly of the West. And there are reasons why these insurgent parties were stronger in the West, because I think the social conflict was more intense there. Needless to say, we aren't talking about having those parties today, are we?
Indeed not, which leads me to the next question, which is, why was there a waning of that political upsurge? Why did these various parties end up disappearing?
Well, there's sort of two ways of explaining it, right? The way that we're always told when the subject comes up is we're told that the existing parties basically adopted what the third party movements wanted, right? That, you know, the third party movements were advocating things like nationalization of basic industry, legislated shorter workday, women's suffrage, free and fair ballot, an end to the use of race to disenfranchise people in the South. And, of course, none of those things got adopted by the major parties. What happens is, in many cases, is the sort of violence that was used in these social conflicts, the violence that were used in the Range War, the violence used to deal with, you know, troublemakers among the cowboys or among the railroad workers, that same kind of violence is employed politically. These are not where they're really successful. These are not simply nominal third parties. They're not protest parties. They're not, you know, running a candidate here or there. They actually are based on these mass organizations. They have a large membership base, and they reflect the needs and concerns and aspirations of the membership. In many cases, in Texas, for example, where you have the Democrats as the overwhelmingly dominant party, at times the Republicans disappear in Texas. They are replaced by union labor or by the People's Party. And in Kansas, of course, famously in the 1890s, the Democrats are basically absorbed in the rising of the populace that then compete with the Republicans as a national party. So it's not as though we're dealing with marginal groups that are doing this. But in terms of how they are responded to, again, you know, there's a question of absolute direct violence. In the case of Arkansas, people who are congressmen are shut down, and we know who did it because their name's in the newspaper, and they were prominent local figures. They're not brought to trial. Nothing happens to them. Arkansas is one of those cases where you have a large population of African Americans that have come in, partly in response to repression elsewhere in the South. Arkansas is sort of something of a sanctuary, and they organized politically as part of this union labor coalition in the late 80s, and black leaders are basically disappearing in Arkansas. I'm sure that this is the sort of case where they were simply eliminated, disappeared
as they would later use the term in parts of Latin America. In Kansas, where you're dealing with people like Samuel N. Wood, who was an old abolitionist, a father of the Republican Party in Kansas, but also someone who was a stalwart ally of the farmers, a proponent of the shorter workday, a friend of the Knights of Labor, and so on. He was sued at one point, and he went to the court to have his hearing in front of the judge, and the judge's bodyguard shot him dead when he got out of the buggy. You know, again, we know who he was. He was an employee of the judge. Nobody's ever brought to trial for these things. Violence becomes something that's sort of accepted as a means of political enforcement, just as it had been accepted before as a means of enforcing the will in terms of range wars or in terms of labor disputes. And again, I would argue that the West in that sense is pioneering things. We go back to Turner's idea of the importance of the frontier in American history, the importance of the settlement of the West in the shaping of the American character. You can really look at a lot of this and see some forebodings of what can happen in terms of the 20th century.
Mark Laws, in terms of the 20th century and the way that the late 19th century, the conquest of the West, the figure of the cowboy, all of these are remembered is very frequently through Hollywood films. In fact, there's a whole genre. What does film and Westerns tell us or not tell us about the real history of cowboys and the history of labor unrest in the American West?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think you think of something like the Johnson County War in 1892. I think of Heaven's Gate. Heaven's Gate supposedly killed the Western, the genre, didn't it? Somehow they kill the Western genre every so often, and it somehow just doesn't quite die on us. But Heaven's Gate was about the Johnson County War, and when you see these dramatic shootouts and so on, and they're, you know, intended to be the sort of elements of the movie that are historically accurate. The killing of Nate Champion, for example, at the Casey Ranch. As near as we know, and the fellow going by in the buckboard in the movie is Oscar Flagg. Oscar Flagg and Nate Champion were leaders of the cowboy strike back in 1886 in Wyoming. So this is a long-standing conflict, a long-standing tension that goes back beyond, you know, 1892. This is sort of the most famous range war in the history of the West, has its origins in a labor conflict a few years earlier. The movies usually don't depict that.
Westerns are interesting because, of course, they're about the figure of the cowboy. But they're also obviously about the mythology of the United States itself and creation myths. You know, obviously, films are often as much about the present as about the past or a vision of the present. How do you see the West as a stand-in, a particular version of the West as presented in films and within a larger mythology as a stand-in for the United States?
It's interesting to think about how they deal with race in Westerns. I mean, on one level, if you see like a remake of something like The Magnificent Seven, that's fabulous. I got a great kick out of that movie. I loved where the villain, who's the great robber baron, right, is talking about how you people will not be remembered. I will be remembered. I mean, those are some really interesting sorts of insights. And yet, in the middle of all of that, there is a complete fictionalization of how the West would have worked. We still are clinging to the mythology, even when we're trying to sort of explore important questions. If we could change the way race worked in the West by making movies in which people are treated as equals, that basically prolongs the mythology on one level. On the other hand, television series like Deadwood, I thought was absolutely fascinating. It annoyed me, but I wound up getting drawn into it. In part because of the importance of women in these communities. These are overwhelmingly male societies, and that gave women an incredible amount of power. And they used it. If you think about the development of women's suffrage, when it actually gets something that is put on the ground, something that becomes practical, It's the West that pioneers women's suffrage, you know, places like Wyoming. And that is an element in terms of how it's depicted frequently today that I think is quite interesting.
Well, let me end by asking you about the role of nature in this whole mythology. You mentioned Turner earlier on, this idea of the frontier. And one of the ways that the West, and to some degree the cowboy as well, are remembered or misremembered today has to do with the marketing of things like SUVs that are supposed to represent the spirit of America and the great frontier of the West. What is the role of nature in all of this when you think back to the really violent transformation of the West in the 19th century and how it's seen from the vantage point of today?
And that nature is being conquered, right? Nature is subjugated. This was, of course, the great idea of the 19th century, the great idea of the Gilded Age and the age of the robber barons and the Industrial Revolution, that they were subjugating nature to human will, and, of course, at least the will of some humans. But at the same time, you do get a response to that. If we think about the environmental movement and we think about the ways people had responded to that ruthlessness in terms of nature, there were some brilliant pioneering thinkers in all of this. I mean, John Muir, in a sense, is going to be coming out of the West. California, we think of them in terms of California, but was very well aware of what was happening to nature everywhere. Or if we think of the great founding thinker of the environmental movement, George Perkins Marsh, Man and Nature, going back to the earliest period of the Republican Party when it was, you know, a people's party, a popular party. Marsh, who was Lincoln's emissary to the Italian states, on his travels would go to the Levant, would go to the Middle East, and he came back and he was writing about the impact of ancient peoples on nature, the deforestation of the Middle East, and how that changed the climate. And, you know, he was talking about the human impact on the climate generations before we had the parade of people today who regularly talk about humans not having an impact, can't have an impact on the climate. The West gave us some real opportunities to do things. And I think that the end result is always going to be mixed. I just saw that the president was getting rid of a lot of acreage of national monument land, turning it over to business uses. But it was set aside at an earlier point for, you know, based on an understanding and a realization of people coming out of the 19th century.
And much more that could be talked about to do with that, and also the history of the displacement of the Native Americans within that larger picture. Unfortunately, we're totally out of time. I've been speaking with historian Mark Laws. He is the author of The Great Cowboy Strike, Bullets, Ballots, and Class Conflicts in the American West. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He is also the author of Race and Radicalism in the Union Army, and his forthcoming book is titled Long Road to Harper's Ferry, The Rise of the First American Left. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.